remembering how three young brothers from the Isle of Wight turned their tiny island into the world centre of counterculture by staging radical music festivals. That's the reunion at 9 o'clock. On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on digital radio. This is BBC Radio 4.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 28th of August. This is Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Henry Zeffman in London.
Good morning. The headlines today. The number of people known to have died in flash flooding in Nepal has risen to 469 as the search goes on for hundreds more still missing. We'll speak to those who are looking for loved ones and hear from a doctor operating in one of the most devastated areas.
There's no electricity, there's no mobile network. We've been using generators at the hospital, but even that has run out of fuel.
And NHS managers say the cost of dealing with autism and ADHD is spiralling out of control, with a tenfold spending increase reported in some parts of England.
Also in today's programme, the Green Party demands a temporary ban on new data centres. We'll hear why at 7:30. And Hubble, James Webb, and now NASA's Nancy Grace Roman. Yes, there's a new super powerful space telescope on the block.
Wide field of view versus sort of a more focused pinpoint. It's the equivalent of a 300 megapixel camera.
And
Alan Turing is known, but not really not a famous figure like he is a famous great 20th century figure now. And we felt that more people should know about him. But I think we have a sense of his personality.
Why the Pet Shop Boys are paying tribute to wartime codebreaker Alan Turing. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
Almost 470 people are known to have died after a devastating flash flood tore through northern Nepal, sweeping away bridges, destroying dams and burying homes under thick mud. The search for survivors continued throughout the night, but Chinese state media is reporting that rescue efforts over the border in Tibet have halted because of the risk of more flooding. Hundreds of people are still missing on both sides, including 33 British nationals. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri sent this report from one of the worst affected areas in Nepal.
Roads are caked in mud in Trishuli, with some vehicles half buried. Police barricades block off entry to some of the worst affected areas near the riverbeds, with warnings of more possible flooding to come. The casualty figures continue to rise in what has become the worst disaster Nepal has seen since an earthquake in 2015. This time, experts believe a glacier collapsing could have triggered flooding. Helicopters are still flying over the mountains, searching for survivors and delivering relief supplies. Hundreds of people have been rescued, including most of the 450 people trapped in a tunnel in Trishuli. Rescue efforts continue, and moments like these offer hope to the families we meet who are desperately waiting for news of their loved ones.
NHS bosses are warning autism and ADHD care in England is at risk of descending into chaos with spiralling costs and unregulated private providers capitalising on the huge demand. The NHS Alliance, which represents health managers, said the current system was a bad deal for patients and taxpayers alike. Here's our health correspondent Nick Triggle.
People needing assessments and care for autism and ADHD in England can choose to be seen by either NHS services or private firms and charities. But with demand increasing, the NHS Alliance said some local health boards were reporting a tenfold increase in spending. A rapid increase in the number of providers also meant NHS managers were struggling to check the safety and quality of services. The government said an independent review of care would be published soon, and it would act on that.
BBC News has found that a police officer who was a violent rapist passed vetting checks despite having two reports of criminal behaviour against women on his record. PC Alan Greer, who took his own life while under investigation, joined the police in Scotland in 2009, even though vetting staff were aware of his past. Our investigations correspondent Mark Daly has this report.
When PC Alan Greer was unmasked last month as a dangerous rapist with at least 9 victims, Police Scotland insisted there'd been no missed opportunities to identify his offending sooner. But Greer was investigated in 2002 and again in 2005 for making inappropriate phone calls to women with one case resulting in a formal police caution. He joyned what was then Strathclyde Police in 2009, despite vetting staff being aware of his offending. Police Scotland said it didn't believe it had been answering questions about Greer's vetting record in its previous comments. It added Greer wouldn't pass vetting by today's standards.
The Ministry of Defence has confirmed to the BBC that more than 1,000 retired service personnel are being pursued for debts because clerical errors meant they were paid too much in their pensions. 70-year-old Ray Lawton from Portsmouth says he's facing an £8,000 bill he can't afford.
It's hard to believe it's happened because I never thought it would happen. I've trusted the army, you know, all my life, even when I left. You know, I still think of the army and I trusted my pension would be right, you know, and what I expected. And then this letter comes and it's just, you know, blown it all out.
The government says the overpayments total £5 million and it has to recover taxpayer funds. The private companies Sopra Steria and Equiniti, which run the pension scheme, say they've acted as quickly as possible. The Green Party of England and Wales has called on the government to slam the brakes on new AI data centres because of the amount of water and energy they use. The centres are treated as critical infrastructure, so planning permission is easier to get. The government argues that a pause would send investment abroad and leave the UK dependent on overseas computing for sensitive data. But the Green leader, Zach Polanski, says new centres should be subject to rigorous environmental standards.
Because it's being deemed as critical infrastructure, it means it can take priorities over people, over local food production, over vital services that actually need this energy and water. When three quarters of a country are in drought, it's very, very clear that if a company or an organisation are going to build a data centre, they need to prove where they're going to get that water from and prove that they can manage it.
Actors, including Hugh Bonneville, Nicola Coughlan and Matt Lucas, are demanding greater legal protection from unauthorised AI clones of their voices. They've signed an open letter calling on the Prime Minister to give every person in the UK a legal right to their own voice. The government says it's consulting on ways to deal with unauthorised digital replicas while protecting legitimate innovation. Our senior technology reporter Chris Vallance has more on the story.
Basic AI voice clones can now be generated from a few seconds of speech. With more original audio, highly convincing duplicates are possible. And as these tools have grown in sophistication, so too have the concerns of voiceover artists and actors who fear losing income to digital knockoffs. The audiobook narrator Alice Socket, who co-founded the current campaign, calls the tech an existential threat to the entire industry. More than 80 actors and vocal performers have signed today's letter.
President Trump has stepped up his trade war with Canada by ordering that Lake Ontario, which is shared by both countries, be renamed Lake America. In response, the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney pointed out that the lake had been called Ontario for 400 years, a name which predated both the US and Canada.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It's 7 minutes past six now. Let's see what the weather has in store today with Ben Rich. Morning, Ben.
Morning, Anna. Thank you very much. Good morning to you. Another day of heavy showers and thunderstorms for parts of the UK. Perhaps not quite with the intensity that some of us saw yesterday, but there could still be enough rain to cause some pretty tricky travelling conditions. And it stays very unsettled, I have to say, into the weekend, which is a bank holiday for many of us. But let's get into the detail for today across the southwest of England, southeast of England, Wales, the Midlands and eastern England. Most places getting off to a dry start. We do have some fog patches around down towards the south of England. They should lift and clear. And then we will see some spells of sunshine, but showers already developing across Wales and the southwest. They will become more widespread through the day. Some of those could be heavy, possibly thundery. Now for northern England, it's a mostly cloudy start to the day and we have some showers around. In fact, some quite heavy downpours right now across parts of South Yorkshire. Even the odd flash of lightning, the odd rumble of thunder. Things will gradually dry up a little bit as we go through the day. Mostly cloudy, one or two showers, but a little drier than it is right now. For Northern Ireland, some of the best of the weather here in terms of dry weather and sunshine. Some rain first thing towards the southeast of Northern Ireland, but then mostly fine with sunny spells. For Scotland, rain initially across some southern and eastern parts. That'll tend to move towards the northeast of Scotland, turning heavy across the Northern Isles. Some sunshine eventually out towards the west. Temperatures north to south across the UK, 17 to 25 degrees. But as I mentioned, as we go through the weekend, we are going to see some rain at times, and some of that will be heavy and thundery.
Thank you, Ben.
At 9 minutes past six, now time for a look at this morning's papers. And as you'd expect, the devastation in Nepal is pictured across many of the front pages. The Daily Mail reports on the British families desperately trying to contact missing relatives after what's described as a tsunami from the sky. The Times says a nurse from Kent is among the missing, while a Sussex businessman, Pramod Pudel, tells the Daily Telegraph from Gatwick Airport that he is travelling back to his Nepalese home village to try to find his wife, his mother, his uncle and his brother. The Guardian focuses on warnings that there could be further flooding with a newly formed lake now at risk of bursting. According to the Financial Times, the disaster is a brutal reminder of the growing risks to people in the Himalayas, which are deeply vulnerable to climate change.
And that's something we'll look at in a little more depth later in the programme, as well as hearing from voices there too, of course. Under siege is the headline in the Daily Mirror this morning, which leads on the deployment of hundreds of additional police officers in Middlesbrough, where it says residents are living in fear because of an alleged gangland turf war. One tells the Daily Express, it seems like the whole town has gone crazy. Another, quoted in The Sun, says it's scary. You wonder what's going to happen next. The paper's front page asks how a UK town could become a war zone.
The iPaper reports that guards at the Chinese embassy in London have been caught threatening protesters with banned electroshock batons. The paper says the incident has sparked a diplomatic row, with the government warning Beijing that it will not tolerate any attempts to coerce, intimidate, harass or harm people on UK soil. The Chinese embassy has been contacted for comment.
Sources have told the Mirror that the Home Office is actively reassessing whether Prince Harry and his family should have taxpayer-funded security. Since moving to the US, the Duke of Sussex has paid for his own protection, but insiders say now that he is back in the UK, the goalposts have moved.
And the Telegraph declares that people over 40 are the last generation of regular drinkers. A study by Our Future Health suggests those in their 40s are 52% more likely than younger people to exceed government alcohol recommendations. It's 11 minutes past six.
Chinese rescue efforts in southern Tibet have been suspended after Wednesday's catastrophic floods and mudslides. This is because there are fears that a lake, which has formed as a result of that, could now burst its banks. There are hundreds of people still missing. Conditions are treacherous. Nearly 400 people we know have been killed. In fact, more than 400 now. That number has increased in Nepal. In Tibet, which is controlled by China, there have still only been three confirmed deaths. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker is following developments from Beijing. Laura, as you explained to us yesterday, a lot of what you hear comes through Chinese state media, which really has a lot of control over the flow of information there.
Yes, but we are hearing within the last few hours that Chinese rescue efforts have been suspended. That is a new development. Chinese state media reporters have managed to get near what is being called this barrier lake. Now, this is a lake that has formed within the debris further up from Girong Port. Now, if anybody's been watching the footage over the last few days, this is the unmistakable place where the torrent of water comes flooding through the V-shaped valley, crashing through the buildings, and you see hundreds of people fleeing for their lives. That has become the epicentre for Chinese rescue efforts. But getting rescuers there is risky because now officials are monitoring this lake and they do believe that due to the weather forecast and the rising water, there is a risk of it breaching and then, of course, affecting relief efforts further down the river. So that is why rescue efforts have been suspended for now. We're keeping an eye on it because obviously with state media reports now there, we are getting more information coming through.
And what about the numbers, Laura, of people who are officially dead and also still missing?
Well, when it comes to these numbers, Chinese state media will only say that 558 people are missing on the Chinese side of the border. We do know that that could include a large number of tourists and hikers who were making their way on the pilgrimage between Nepal and Tibet. And it's understood that a large number, a large group had actually checked in at the border at that time. When it comes to those rescued, they're saying that two people have been rescued and three people have been confirmed dead. However, they have managed to rescue a number of people from nearby. So they've taken a large group, more than 1,000 people who were in the nearby town, which is several kilometres away from the epicentre of this tragedy in the southern part of Tibet. And 500 of those are tourists. So they are managing to get people out of the area. What they are still struggling to do is get rescuers in to the real disaster zone.
Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, thank you.
14 minutes past six. ADHD and autism costs for the NHS in England are spiralling out of control. That's the warning this morning from the body which represents health trusts and hospitals. Well, Nick Triggle is our health correspondent and he has been covering this. And Nick, these are really stark increases in costs we're talking about, aren't they?
Yes, they are, Henry. The NHS Alliance has been gathering evidence from local health boards and they control much of the NHS budget. One board said it's seen costs rise tenfold in the space of a year. Another was spending £4 million a year 2 years ago, and that has now increased to £30 million. So these costs, NHS Alliance say, are spiralling out of control, and that's not good for patients or taxpayers. A big factor in what's happened is what is being charged. One health board said it was paying between £300 and £3,000 for similar services, and that's because a mixed market has developed. There's a policy known as Right to Choose, which allows patients to decide to get treated by an NHS trust or to go to a private firm or a charity. The idea is to allow them to bypass some of the longest long waiting lists. And it's working to some extent. Those long waits are coming down, but it's coming at a cost. And as long with the rising spend, the local health boards are warning that the rapid increase in the numbers of different providers means they're struggling to carry out the necessary checks and monitoring to ensure quality and safety. So they're saying it's a real concern.
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it, there, Nick? Because there's two things going on in terms of the care of people with autism and ADHD. On the one hand, this suggestion that the right to choose, the right to go to a private provider is meaning faster treatment for people. But then there's also this warning, isn't there, from the NHS Alliance that that means that some of them are being forced into the care of unregulated private providers.
Yes, absolutely. There's been huge demand we've seen in the last few years for assessments and for support. And the system sort of tried to respond to that. Now, what the NHS Alliance is saying needs to happen is that there needs to be a national tariff. So set prices for all the different assessments and treatments that are being offered. This is similar to what happens in routine care for things like knee and hip replacements. Private providers carry out lots of operations, but they do it at the same price as NHS trusts. What everyone is looking towards is a major independent review that is expected to be published soon. The government says it will act on that and develop a new national approach.
Okay, Nick Triggle, thank you very much. And we'll speak to the Director of Mental Health for the NHS Alliance, as well as somebody waiting for an ADHD assessment at 10 minutes to 8.
17 minutes past six now, the financial markets will be focusing their attention on Jackson Hole in the US state of Wyoming this afternoon. Theo Leggett is here to tell us why and has the rest of the day's business news as well. Morning, Theo.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Henry. Yes, this is the annual gathering of central bankers and financial policymakers, which is taking place in Jackson Hole, a town in the mountains of Wyoming. It is a major event packed with power brokers. And the key speaker today is Kevin Warsh, the new chair of the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve. The meeting comes at a key time for the US economy, with government borrowing costs hovering around multi-decade highs, inflation running above the Fed's target since early 2021, and concerns about the size of the US government's budget deficit. That's the amount it spends over and above its income. Not to mention possible tensions between the Treasury and the central bank itself. I'm joined now by Catherine Knight, who's Deputy Head of Global Economics at PGIM. At PGIM Credit, one of the world's largest bond investors. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So, a keynote speech from the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Everybody's waiting to hear what he has to say. What are you expecting?
I'm expecting him, based on what he's alluded to in earlier comments, to really frame the big questions. We can only speculate here, but think of things, for example, like AI and the impact on productivity and what that could mean for the interest rate environment over the medium to long run. I think what we're not expecting to hear from the new chair of the Federal Reserve is any sort of hand-holding, if you like, on where next for interest rates, for example, at their forthcoming meeting in September.
So markets won't get guidance on that. Paul Warsh was President Trump's pick for Fed chairman, but he, politically speaking, he has a difficult tightrope to walk, doesn't he?
Yes, yes, he does. He has so far come across as sounding quite hawkish. That is, someone who is emphasizing the importance of price stability and the need for inflation to be at the 2% inflation target. So he has very much, you know, said all the right things in that regard thus far. But at the same time, I suspect that may not be quite enough for markets at this next intervention from him that we're expecting at Jackson Hole. I think markets really will be looking for more from him, not so much in terms of where interest rates are going next, but how does the Federal Reserve see its interest rate decision linked to different scenarios in terms of different macroeconomic outcomes. And I think especially markets will want to hear the new chair say that if inflation is expected to continue to run meaningfully above the 2% target, that they will raise interest rates. And if he doesn't do that, then I think there is a risk that markets could get spooked.
And of course, President Trump himself is very much in favor of reducing interest rates, isn't he?
Yes, but we do have an independent central bank that is there to guide interest rates and to ensure that credibility is maintained around the 2% inflation target. And ultimately, that is in, you know, any president's best interest, because that is really the best way to deliver, you know, long run sustainable growth in the real economy. And I think that, you know, that is not really under any question here.
That's non-negotiable.
yes.
Now, last week, we saw the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, intervene in the bond markets to try and bring down borrowing costs, which had been rising. It wasn't particularly successful, but that put him on a potential collision course with Mr. Warsh, didn't it?
I'm not sure I would frame it quite like that. Clearly, I think it does put more pressure on the central bank in the United States to really clarify that, as I've said, you know, if inflation were to continue to run meaningfully above the target, that they are prepared and indeed would raise interest rates. That pressure, I think, is just added by this latest intervention from the Treasury, because markets have this dual concern that you mentioned at the start of your piece, that inflation in the U.S. does continue to run just a bit too hot, and that there are concerns that the government debt trajectory is simply not sustainable. And therefore, that just puts more pressure, more onus on a central bank. And that pressure is magnified by the fact that we have a new sheriff in town, if you like. We don't know that much about him because he hasn't told us very much. And he says he really wants to do things differently. And that's what is putting this Jackson Hole event sort of on an elevated position in terms of importance in the annual economic calendar.
Catherine, thank you very much indeed. That was Catherine Nice, Deputy Head of Global Economics at PGIM Credit, one of the world's largest bond investors. Now, we saw tech stocks rising yesterday on the US stock markets. Shares in the chip-making giant Nvidia jumped by nearly 9% following some impressive sales results. That pushed up the value of the company by $442 billion. That's the second largest daily gain by any stock ever. I'm joined now by Caroline Simmons, who's Chief Investment Officer at Quilter Cheviot. Caroline, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Why such a massive jump? I mean, these were good sales figures, but that's an awful lot of extra money being piled into the company.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the results, as you say, were good. Growth increased to about 106%, which was a pickup on the prior quarter. But they also addressed, I think, some of the concerns that are out there. You know, one is the sort of durability of growth and how fast or how long can you continue to grow this fast? And they guided to revenue growth of about 70% for 2028, and they have a 2-year, you know, order backlog. So I think that sort of reassured the market on the durability. They, you know, continued their buyback, which, you know, reminded everyone of the strength of their balance sheet and the strong cash flow generation that they're creating. And then the other sort of concern out there is around the sort of circular financing, where, you know, they lend money to essentially their clients, essentially. And we're sort of getting a little bit more estimates around the potential return on capital that can bring, and the payback periods might be sort of 1 to 4 years, which is quite quick for a payback period, and sort of would alleviate some of the concerns around that behaviour.
Caroline, thanks very much indeed. That was Caroline Simmons, Chief Investment Officer at Quilter Cheviot. Now, the boss of one of Britain's largest energy companies has urged the government to stay the course on the transition to net zero and clean energy. Keith Anderson, the chief executive of Scottish Power, has said that investment in the sector is key to achieving Andy Burnham's goal of boosting regional growth. And on that topic, the Prime Minister has announced that in October, he'll be convening a National Economic Council with leaders from Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland to look at ways of promoting growth, as he puts it, in every postcode. So Mr. Anderson joins us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So why, in your opinion, is continued investment in clean energy so critical to future growth?
Well, look, I think what we need to do is we need to have an energy system that is fit for purpose and an energy system that delivers safe, secure, reliable, efficient, effective and low-cost energy. And the more we move away from volatile gas markets and volatile fossil fuel markets, the better. And the critical part of it is also investing in our network. We're on a mission to invest £25 to £30 billion in that network. And that network will generate economic growth. It will allow other investors to come in, manufacturers, AI technology, data centres, to invest in the UK as well. And by building out that network, we're creating thousands of jobs. And one of the other big things, as well as creating economic growth, is we need to create employment opportunities the length and breadth of the country for young people. And again, that will generate more and more work. You know, and we're giving out contracts just now to companies from Caithness to Cornwall, companies like Ludden, £40 million contract that's employing hundreds of people. And that's what we need to do.
There are likely to be plenty of people out there who disagree with you. They'll be saying that net zero is pushing up energy costs, which are already sky high, and that's hurting businesses.
So right now, most of the energy costs that's coming through in the UK and the increases that we've seen and the volatility that we've seen in energy prices is being caused by what's going on across the rest of the world. The geopolitical issues that we've got, the wars that we've got, pushing up the price of gas, that's making gas on the wholesale market go up in price massively. It's trading about 3 times its normal value. That feeds through directly into customers' gas price, but it also affects the electricity price in the UK, because a lot of the electricity in the UK is generated by burning gas. And the more we can move away from that, the less volatile we'll be, the less reliant we'll be on those markets. And what we'll be using is good, clean energy in the UK that we control, we manage, and we can look at how to plan it out. And that, again, will allow more economic growth in the country. It will allow us to invest more money. It will make the system better for customers and for businesses in the UK.
But investment in renewables does cost money. And if it pushes up energy costs, it could actually hurt energy-intensive businesses, which are often based in the regions away from the prosperous southeast, won't it?
So, look, we need more electricity in the UK. So if we want to have economic growth, we need to electrify the economy. So right now it's vital that we build a network capable of allowing that growth. And it's also important that we build a new generation. And today, the cheapest forms of new investment in generation are onshore wind, solar and offshore wind, cheaper than any other form of investment. So if we need more electricity for economic growth,
That's how we should invest in it, and that's how we should deliver it. The government are helping with bills. They're helping with bills for consumers through taking policy costs off the bill, taking VAT off the bill, and they're also bringing forward a proposal for high energy users to bring down their energy costs as well while we go through this transition. And that's also incredibly important because it will allow those businesses to carry on and it will allow that investment to flow through the system.
Keith Anderson, Chief Executive of Scottish Power, thank you very much indeed, and I'll be back in about an hour.
Thanks, Theo. It's 29 minutes past six, and Mike's here with the sports news.
Morning, Henry. Let's start with cricket, shall we? Because the second test is finally poised at Lord's after Pakistan reduced England to 248 for nine at the close of the opening day yesterday. The story of day one from Eleanor Oldroyd.
A seesawing day which started late because of rain and ended early because of bad light. Pakistan's seamers took full advantage of winning the toss, with Mohammed Abbas brilliant in the morning session, taking 3 for 34. Joe Root, who spent the build-up to the game talking about matters off the field, not having a happy time on it either, out LBW for 4. England recovered after lunch, adding 100 for just one wicket in the afternoon session, with Jordan Cox and Jamie Smith both hitting half centuries. Cox fell to a sensational catch in the slip, and Pakistan fought back again after tea, with Muhammad Ali dismissing Smith and Ollie Robinson in one over with two brilliant deliveries. England will resume on 243 for nine, with their own seamers no doubt looking forward to the prospect of getting going in similar conditions.
Let's get some reaction from inside the England camp now, shall we? Here is wicketkeeper Jamie Smith.
Yeah, I guess overall it's been a good day for us being inserted on that surface. I think we knew that it'd be a little bit tricky. Lord's is always a bit tricky at times with the over conditions, and the ball seemed to do enough throughout the day's play there. And also credit to Pakistan, I thought they bowled nicely. Took a few early wickets up top, which put us under a bit of pressure. But yeah, overall very pleased to be in that position.
Day two from Lord's is live on Test Match Special this morning. Coverage getting underway at 10:30. You can listen on BBC Sounds. Next to football, and a miserable night for Rangers in Europe.
Kramosta, up he comes, and scores! Yablonec are through! The Rangers fans and Rangers players in disbelief. They have turned in an absolutely dismal performance here tonight in the north of the Czech Republic, and they have got ultimately what they deserve.
Yes, there will be no European football at all for Rangers this season, after they were knocked out of the Europa Conference League by the Czech side Jablonec last night. Derek McInnes' side were 1-0 up going into the second leg, but eventually lost 4-3 on penalties.
First of all, I'm embarrassed with the performance. I think the only people who represented the club well tonight were my staff, the support staff and the preparation, and the supporters who, to a man, were outstanding. I'm not going to sit here and make any excuses whatsoever. It wasn't good enough. The responsibility is mine to make sure that we are better than what we served up tonight. I'm mortified by the performance.
Bad night for Scottish sides all round, because Motherwell and Hibs were also knocked out of Europe, as are Northern Ireland's Larne. Brighton, however, have secured a return to European football. They put 4 goals past the Norwegian side Tromsø to claim a place in the Europa League league phase. And away from football, finally, in athletics, a big night in Zurich last night, and the Swiss favourite Audrey Wero edged closer to the oldest record in athletics as she won the 800 metres in a personal best of 1:53.70. That is just 0.4 of a second shy of the world record. Femke Bruder's Boll came in second, with Britain's Georgia Hunter-Bell in third with a season's best. And we'll have more athletics chat reflecting on the night's action in Zurich in the next hour of the programme.
Thank you, Mike.
I'm David Dimbleby. I've reported on America for decades.
The United States, whatever our faults may be, is the hope of the world.
America seen as the head of the free world. And yet today, that idea is in crisis.
From the History Podcast, Invisible Hands, The American Century.
The story of how the United States became a superpower at the head of a new global order, and the invisible hands that guided it.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
The time is 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Henry Zeffman in London, and with a summary of the news, Lisa Costello.
Chinese rescue efforts in southern Tibet have been suspended after Wednesday's catastrophic floods and mudslides. After hours of heavy rain, there are fears that a lake that has formed could burst its banks and cause more flooding. So far, more than 1,000 people have been evacuated from the disaster zone in the Tibetan side. Hundreds remain missing in northern Nepal, where almost 470 people are now known to have died. NHS bosses say the cost of autism and ADHD care in England is spiralling out of control, with some local health boards reporting a tenfold increase in spending. The NHS Alliance warns that unregulated private providers are capitalising on the huge demand for help. The government says an independent review of services will be published soon, which it will act on. BBC News has found that a police officer exposed as a violent serial rapist passed vetting checks despite having two reports of criminal behaviour against women on his record. PC Alan Greer, who took his own life while under investigation for sex crimes, joined the police in Strathclyde in 2009, even though vetting staff were aware of his criminal past. Police Scotland says Greer would not pass vetting by today's standards. A number of military veterans have contacted BBC News saying they're in financial limbo after being told their pensions have been overpaid due to clerical errors. The Ministry of Defence has confirmed more than 1,000 retired service personnel are being pursued for debts. The government says it has to recover taxpayer funds. The Green Party of England and Wales is calling on the government to pause the approval of new data centres in the UK because of concerns about water supplies. The Greens say the centres shouldn't be treated as critical infrastructure. The government argues that freezing projects would drive investment and jobs abroad. An official report has warned Scotland's universities are facing an annual funding gap of £200 million, which it says could widen further because the number of foreign students is falling. Scottish undergraduates don't pay tuition fees in the country, a policy the Scottish government has defended.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 25 to 7 now. Let's return to the situation on the China-Nepal border. Those areas worst affected by flash flooding remain largely cut off, which is making rescue and recovery efforts difficult. We do know that more than 400 people have been confirmed dead in Nepal. Our correspondent Azadeh Mashiri is in Trishuli, where a major rescue effort is underway. Azadeh, just tell us what you are seeing and hearing around you there.
Yeah, you may be able to hear the helicopter that's flying above me right now. I've reached army barracks in Trishuli in the northern part of Nepal. And here, helicopters have been dropping off the injured, survivors, every few minutes. They're also taking off with some supplies. And on the other side of the army barracks gates are just some of the people in Nepal who are hoping for news of their loved ones. Because here, the army has been publishing a list of people who have been found. So many of the people here are gathering around that, hoping they'll see a name that they recognize. They're also taking names of more people who are said to be missing. That number, sadly, does keep rising, including hundreds of pilgrims and foreign tourists who are still missing, including 33 British tourists and two teenagers, sadly.
We know on the Chinese side in Tibet that those rescue and recovery operations have been halted because of the risk to the people doing it, because a newly formed lake is at risk of breaking its banks. Just give us an idea, Azadeh. We know that, as we were saying, many places are cut off. That operation to try and find survivors, bring them to hospital, as you were describing there, is a really difficult one.
It is, and that's why a lot of the injured are also being airlifted to a hospital in the capital, Kathmandu, which is about 3 hours south of here, for them to seek care. And the fact is also that the connectivity is impossible. A lot of the people we've been speaking to are holding on to the last phone conversation they've had with their loved ones. I spoke to one woman who had spoken to her husband on a voice call yesterday at 8:30 a.m. He was a driver who was driving around a group of tourists. Earlier today, I spoke to a sister and a brother who have lost relatives, a mother and a child. And unfortunately, they've seen all the photos and videos on social media of their family home just completely covered in mud. And Anna, this is just such a different feeling to the last time I was here. I was here a little over 6 months ago when the Prime Minister Balan Shah was elected, there was so much hope. People were so excited about a political newcomer, someone who'd only had 3 years as mayor as political experience. And now a little over 6 months, he's now dealing with the biggest disaster Nepal has faced since an earthquake in 2015. So in more than a decade. And all the people around me right now are counting on him and emergency workers to keep saving lives.
Yeah, a real challenge for him and that relatively new administration, as you described. Thank you, Azadeh Mashiri there, our correspondent in Trishuli in Nepal.
22 minutes to seven. Debates about where and whether to build data centres have become one of the major political dividing lines in the United States in recent months. Here, too, the unease is growing, with significant opposition to new developments in communities ranging from Fife to Keswick to Brick Lane, to name just a few. Well, now the Green leader, Zach Polanski, is calling for a freeze on the approval of new data centres in England because of concerns about the amount of water and energy they use. Jack Fenwick is our political correspondent and joins us now from Westminster. Good morning, Jack. And the Greens want these centres to be subject to higher environmental standards, don't they?
That's right, Henry. Data centres were classed as critical infrastructure in 2024. Now, the Greens argue that that means they could get priority over households for water. The government says that's not necessarily the case. Now, data centres can use significant amounts of water to cool their systems. There aren't any official figures on how much they consume in the UK because they don't have to currently report the amount of water they use. But we do know that many are clustered around London and the southeast of England. They are areas officially in drought at the moment. The Green Party leader Zach Polanski has said we need to slam the brakes on new data centre approvals. He's called for this moratorium. He said to most people, critical infrastructure means hospitals, water, electricity. It doesn't mean artificial intelligence. And his party want the government to introduce stricter environmental rules and also give communities more say on whether centres are built in their areas.
Well, artificial intelligence has been critical to this government's plan for growth, hasn't it, Jack? At least under Keir Starmer. We haven't heard lots from Andy Burnham on the subject. Have we heard anything from the government in response to this Green announcement?
Yeah, I mean, this does look set to continue under Andy Burnham. The government's AI minister now attends Cabinet. On the specifics of this story, the government has said that a freeze on the approval of new data centres would be a disaster for jobs and national security. Now, the Greens are citing research by an environmental charity which suggests large centres could consume 1.5 million litres of water a day. The government actually says that much more water, around a fifth of the supply, is lost through leaks. A spokesperson said that a pause on building new data centres would simply send investment and good jobs abroad. But they said this does not mean a blank check for big tech or that every data centre should be approved. They added developers must plan to use clean power, use water responsibly, create British jobs and provide investment to the communities in which they're built.
Jack Fenwick, thank you.
It's 19 minutes to seven. A police officer exposed as a violent serial rapist passed vetting checks despite having two reports of criminal behaviour against women on his record. The BBC can reveal that PC Alan Greer, who took his own life while under investigation by his force, Police Scotland, for rape and sexual assault, was admitted to the police in 2009 despite vetting staff being aware of his criminal past. Mark Daly is from BBC Scotland's disclosure team. Mark, tell us a bit more about this story.
Good morning, Anna. Yeah, well, last month, the BBC unmasked PC Alan Greer, who was a veteran police officer with 17 years of apparently unblemished service, as a serial rapist with a history of violent offending and attempted murder against women. Now, he took his own life in May, just days after Police Scotland detectives raided his home as part of what became a massive anti-corruption investigation into his offences, which date back to, as far as the police knew, at least 2012, when he raped a vulnerable woman just hours after he met her in the course of his duties. Now, examination of seized electronic devices revealed that he'd had contact with hundreds of sex workers during his police career, and he'd violently attacked many of them. Police Scotland have so far identified 15 victims of Greer. Now, given the high-profile cases we've seen across the UK concerning rogue officers like David Carrick, Wayne Cousins, a question is always, how did they get into the police in the first place? Were there no opportunities to stop them sooner? And that's exactly what I asked Assistant Chief Constable Lynn Ratcliffe of Police Scotland last month.
There is nothing to suggest that there have been any missed opportunities over the years.
But you can't rule out that there may have been some red flags that have been missed.
At this stage, we've got no evidence to suggest that is the case.
So what have you found, Mark?
Well, we found that there absolutely were red flags about this man prior to joining the police. We learned he was investigated by what was then Strathclyde Police in 2002 for making inappropriate calls to a woman, basically silent phone calls. That case was reported to the Crown Office in Scotland, and although no further action was taken, that information would have been retained. Then he was investigated again in 2005 by the Met Police, this time the Metropolitan Police in London, for exactly the same offence, making inappropriate calls to a woman in London. And for this, he accepted a formal police caution. And we now know that 4 years later, when he applied to join Strathclyde Police, the Legacy Force, the force vetting unit there, was aware of at least the 2005 caution. It appears to have been raised during the interview process and possibly the earlier offence too. So the force vetting unit knew about the offending, yet still he was allowed to join the force.
And now you've found that out, what are Police Scotland saying now?
Well, Police Scotland has moved to clarify its earlier comments. It said that it had provided answers to questions relating to Alan Greer's offending during the course of his police career and did not believe it had been answering questions about his police vetting record. It said that the recruitment and vetting process carried out by Strathclyde Police will form part of an independent and external review by the National Police Chiefs Council, and it said it was imperative that it didn't disclose any information which could be detrimental to the support that it is providing for Greer's victims. And it added that Greer would not have passed the more stringent vetting checks that are in place today. Now, for the time being, though, the investigation into Alan Greer's offending goes on. As I was saying, it's a huge investigation spanning many years, and it's expected, spanning many years of offences, and it's expected that more victims will emerge. And I think in light of today's news, there will be more calls for full transparency around this Police Scotland investigation.
Thank you, Mark. That's Mark Daly from BBC Scotland's disclosure team.
It's 7:15. More than 1,000 former members of the military have been told they have to pay thousands of pounds to the government because their pensions were overpaid due to a clerical error. We know about this because veterans across the UK who receive letters out of the blue from the government demanding money that they didn't know they owed have contacted BBC Your Voice. One of them is Andrew Thorburn, who served 36 years in the Royal Navy, but says he's now been told to repay £26,438 because his pension wasn't adjusted when he reached the state pension age. His military pension has also been cut immediately by around £650 to £700 a month.
At first, I thought it was a scam. Didn't believe it. This is hanging over us, and the stress of it, I just cannot describe to you. This is how you're treating the veterans. What message does that send out to the youngsters of the future who we do want to serve?
Well, Major General Neil Marshall is Chief Executive of the Forces Pension Society, an independent organisation which acts as a pension watchdog for those who've served in the armed forces. And I'm pleased to say he joins us now. Good morning, Mr. Marshall.
Good morning, Henry, and thank you for covering this important subject.
Well, give us a sense of what the impact has been on the veterans affected by this.
Well, much as the Ministry of Defence say that that they will manage this empathetically, veterans have spent their entire military career sort of trusting authority and understanding it with responsibility becomes accountability. And the irony here is that they are now being held accountable for the Ministry of Defence and the contractors' errors. So the impact is profound. And of course, it happens to members in retirement when their life plans have been made, their standard of living is set, and they lack the wherewithal to earn additional money to repay these overpayments, which of course have been paid to them monthly, often over up to a decade.
And also, as we were hearing from Andrew Thorburn there, at a time when these veterans had no sense whatsoever that this was in the offing. But does the government actually have any other options here? Because they say that they have no choice really but to seek to recover money which should have stayed in the Exchequer and has instead been sent in error to these people.
Yes, but it's the means by which the government and the Ministry of Defence recover that money, going straight to the veterans, whereas actually the Defence Business Services Veterans UK are ultimately responsible for the management and oversight of the pension scheme. And the pension administrators, Sopra Steria and Equiniti, and it's Equiniti who are the pension paymaster and deal directly with the veterans who receive an armed forces pension. So if the Ministry of Defence cannot hold those organizations to account, then it will have to review the decision to recover the monies from the individual veterans. This is about aligning authority, responsibility, and accountability. And the accountability and the liability is now being laid upon the individual veterans rather than the organisations who made the errors in the first place, the pension administrator.
Well, Sopra Steria say that these errors originated over a decade before they took over the contract. And they say that when the issue was identified, they sought guidance from the Ministry of Defence about how to proceed. They say whether and how to recoup taxpayers' money was not a decision for them. So presumably it's to the Ministry of Defence that you are ultimately making this call for them to approach this differently?
Yes, well, ultimately it is the Ministry of Defence's challenge here, but they commission those pension administrators to administer the pensions efficiently. And if they haven't put the contractual framework in place that accounts for those errors, the MOD can't compel those it has contracted to pay for the errors, then the MOD itself should review its decision to recoup these historical payments from individual veteran pensioners. So yes, it's an MOD problem, but the MOD has a pension scheme in place where those organisations responsible for errors are not being held accountable for those errors.
Okay.
And ultimately, the liability lies onto the individual veteran. That just cannot be correct.
Neil Marshall, Chief Executive of the Forces Pension Society, thank you. And should just say the Ministry of Defence have said that where payments have been made in genuine error, they have a responsibility to recover taxpayer funds, but they seek to do so in a sensitive and proportionate way.
It's 10 to 7. 80 big names from the arts world have signed an open letter to the Prime Minister asking for their and our voices to be protected from AI cloning. They want a law change so each of us owns, essentially, our own voice, which would stop companies lifting and copying them and using them for whatever purpose they chose without our consent. Peter Caulfield is an actor, the founder of the Save Our Voices Now campaign. Jen Brister, comedian and actor, is with us as well. Morning, both.
Morning. How are you?
Yeah, well, thank you. Peter, we know that this tech exists. Is this actually happening in the real world? People are having their voices cloned and used and there's nothing they can do about it.
Absolutely. It's not just artists and actors who are having their voices cloned either. I mean, we know there's obviously very high profile cases that are happening at the moment. I mean, there have been legal cases as well where people have been claiming that their voices have been cloned and used without their consent. Obviously, we know people like David Attenborough has had his voice cloned tens of thousands of times just on one website, a website called Audiofish, over 48,000 clones of his voice on there. And he's publicly said, you know, I'm profoundly disturbed to find that these days my identity is being stolen by others. But that's just kind of, at the very top end of things. But if it's happening to David Attenborough, it kind of leaves the rest of us very open to this kind of technology as well. Yeah, sorry, Jen, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, which is why you wanted to change things and actually change the law. And I suppose, Jen, what Peter said there was an interesting point. You know, we don't always think about it, but your voice is very much your identity. And we normally have the choice about what we choose to put our voice to.
Absolutely. And we, you know, there are all kinds of nefarious ways that your identity can be used, whether it be your voice or your face, with the advent of AI, which is completely unregulated. And, you know, yes, there is there's going to be a huge loss of income for many actors and voiceover artists and including comedians like myself, because our voices are out there. You know, as a comedian, my stand-up is online and my voice can be easily used. And as an activist as well, as someone who's very politically active, there is also an existential threat for me. It feels like that my voice could be used by bad actors to represent me in a way that goes against my moral compass or my political views. And if it can happen to me, the danger is that it can literally happen to anyone. And a lot of people don't realize how, you know, your voices are out there, particularly if you have young teenage children who use the, you know, what many of the apps that are available, whether it be Snapchat or WhatsApp or Instagram, their voices are already out there on the ether and anyone can clone them. To give you an example, a friend of mine who has children who are teenagers who went away to for a gap year, one of their daughters, she got a phone call from one of them to say, oh, can you, I mean, you know, I've lost my phone. I'm using somebody else's phone and I've lost my wallet. Could you wire me some money to this account? And she did. And it turned out it wasn't her daughter at all. Somebody had cloned her voice. So this is, you know, one of the many reasons why this technology has to be regulated and there needs to be legal recourse if your voice is used without your consent.
Yeah. And so in short, Jen, your message to the Prime Minister is this is it's one of those, we talk about tech moving so fast, but you're saying this is one of those moments where we've identified a problem and you need to regulate to solve it.
Absolutely. And it needs to be regulated immediately because, you know, as you know, we can see the results of when tech isn't regulated and the impact it can have, not just on people's mental health. You know, we're at a point now where tech is not only, you know, stealing our time. This, we spend so much time on our phones and on our apps. We're now at a point where it can steal our identity, and that should scare everyone.
Yeah, it's a worrying development, isn't it? Thank you both. Really appreciate your time this morning, Jen Brister and Peter Caulfield.
It's 6 minutes to seven. Last night, President Trump signed an executive order seeking to change the name of Lake Ontario, one of the Great Lakes which straddle the US-Canadian border, to Lake America.
The lake change, Lake of America, was something I've been thinking about for a long time, actually. As you know, we took something called the Gulf of Mexico. We changed it, and now it's very routinely the Gulf of America. So if you think about it, we have a gulf and we have a lake. Now all we need is an ocean. So maybe we'll have to change the name of the Atlantic and or the Pacific. Maybe we'll change them both.
Well, that announcement came after trade talks collapsed between the US and Canada late last week, with both sides implementing fresh tariffs. David Smith is The Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief and joins us now. And David, it's not the first time he's tried this, of course. The Gulf of Mexico, now known by President Trump, at least, as the Gulf of America. What's the reaction to this announcement been in the US so far?
Well, that's right. I think a lot of people regard it as a stunt and see it with some consternation at a moment when America is at war with Iran and dealing with a cost of living crisis for millions of people. And so we've seen certainly Donald Trump's allies in the White House cheering him on with this. And he had a map of the new so-called Lake America up there. But otherwise, Republicans mostly silent on it and a chorus of condemnation from Democrats, including Kathy Hochul, who's the governor of New York State, which borders this lake. She dismissed it as silly talk and said New York won't be calling it that. And indeed, some Democrats in the House of Representatives are reportedly gathering to create some counter legislation to make the point that many Americans are not on board with this.
When it comes to the Canadian side, David, sorry to interrupt, Mark Carney treating this with disdain because this is part of a broader piece, isn't it, where relations between the two countries are at their lowest ebb practically ever.
Yeah, I think certainly for half a century since the Vietnam War, this is a real low point in US-Canada relations. It's been such a strong partnership over those decades, but Donald Trump, of course, came into office joking or maybe not joking about annexing Canada, making it the 51st state, publishing maps where Canada is coloured in with the American flag. And now it's reached a new low point after those trade negotiations broke down last week. Trump, of course, imposing 50% tariffs on around $20 billion worth of Canadian goods. And last weekend, we saw a pretty robust speech from Mark Carney in response, describing this as, in terms of it being a war and Canada being under attack, and saying, you know, we've learned the United States signature is written in pencil quite often these days. And, you know, he's still pushing back hard, including on the Lake Ontario issue. And he pointed out that that name predates both Canada and the US, and certainly Canada is not going to...
Okay, David Smith from The Guardian. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Next Thursday, Radio 4 marks the return of the Bayer tapestry to the UK after almost 1,000 years with a special day of Norman-themed programmes.
Norman Day on BBC Radio 4.
1066, perhaps the most famous year in all of English history. And in a special edition of You're Dead to Me, we're exploring what led to the seismic Battle of Hastings.
Harold ends up in Normandy.
We don't know what. He's trying some croissants.
The story has it all. Multiple battles, an alleged illicit affair, and a lot of horses.
If you've got, say, 3,000 horses, how much poo do you think they would produce?
Join me, Greg Jenner, and my guests for You're Dead to Me, part of Norman Day on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. That's next Thursday afternoon at 4.
Let's check the weather. Here's Ben Rich.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Still some rain around today, perhaps not quite as intense as the downpours were yesterday, but some could still be heavy and thundery. Across the south of England, Wales, the Midlands, eastern England, the day is getting off to a largely fine start with some sunny spells, but some showers already across Wales and the southwest. They will become more widespread. They could turn heavy and thundery later. Now for northern England, a lot of cloud around this morning, some quite heavy rain across parts of northeast England, Yorkshire, at the moment. The rain tending to ease off for a time, but some heavy thundery showers will continue into the afternoon. Northern Ireland having some of the driest of the weather today. Early rain in the southeast clearing to leave some sunny spells and just the odd shower. For Scotland, there will be rain across eastern areas. That rain turning heavy in the northeast of Scotland later. Some sunshine out towards the west and temperatures north to south 17 to 25 degrees.
Thank you, Ben. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Henry Zeffman in London.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Friday the 28th of August. The headlines this morning, flash floods in Nepal are now known to have killed at least 469 people. Rescue efforts in Tibet have been suspended because of the threat of more flooding. We'll hear from a doctor operating in one of the most devastated areas.
There's no electricity, there's no mobile network. We've been using generators at the hospital, but even that has run out of fuel.
NHS managers in England say the cost of dealing with autism and ADHD is spiralling out of control, with spending up tenfold in some places. And BBC News has discovered that a police officer who was a violent rapist passed vetting checks despite reports of criminal behaviour against women.
Coming up in the next hour, the Green Party demands a temporary ban on new data centres. We'll hear why at 7:30. Players threatened, officials headbutted, and more than 70 red cards in 1 week. Why a Scottish league has cancelled this weekend's games for under fives. And
Alan Turing is known, but not really not a famous figure like he is, a famous great 20th century figure now. And we felt that more people should know about him. But I think we have a sense of his personality.
How the Pet Shop Boys are paying tribute to wartime codebreaker Alan Turing. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
Almost 470 people are now known to have died after a devastating flash flood tore through northern Nepal, sweeping away bridges, destroying dams and burying homes under thick mud. The search for survivors continued throughout the night, but hundreds of people are still missing, including 33 British nationals. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri sent this report from one of the worst affected areas in Nepal.
Roads are caked in mud in Trishuli, with some vehicles half buried. Police barricades block off entry to some of the worst affected areas near the riverbeds, with warnings of more possible flooding to come. The casualty figures continue to rise in what has become the worst disaster Nepal has seen since an earthquake in 2015. This time, experts believe a glacier collapsing could have triggered flooding. Helicopters are still flying over the mountains, searching for survivors and delivering relief supplies. Hundreds of people have been rescued, including most of the 450 people trapped in a tunnel in Trishuli. Rescue efforts continue, and moments like these offer hope to the families we meet who are desperately waiting for news of their loved ones.
An operation by Chinese authorities to rescue survivors across the border in Tibet has been paused because of fears of further flooding. There are concerns that a lake which formed after a landslide could burst its banks. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker is monitoring developments from Beijing.
Experts in China have been flying drones and mapping out two lakes that have formed in the debris of Wednesday's landslide. They are racing to reduce the risk of more flooding as rescuers try to access Geerong Port, the land border between Nepal and Tibet that was washed away in a torrent of mud and water. More than 500 people are missing in the area. Officials now fear that after hours of heavy rain, the lake could burst its banks in the coming days. Rescuers have been told to stop operations for now, according to reports in Chinese state media. Meanwhile, more than 1,000 people have been rescued from the disaster zone in southern Tibet, including over 500 tourists.
NHS bosses are warning autism and ADHD care in England is at risk of descending into chaos with spiralling costs and unregulated private providers capitalising on the huge demand. The NHS Alliance, which represents health managers, said the current system was a bad deal for patients and taxpayers alike. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
People needing assessments and care for autism and ADHD can choose to be seen by either NHS services or private firms and charities. The policy is designed to help patients in England bypass long waiting lists. But with demand increasing, the NHS Alliance said it had come at a cost, with some local health boards reporting a tenfold increase in spending. This was partly being driven by a huge variation in charges. In one case, the NHS was paying between £300 and £3,000 for similar services. A rapid increase in the number of providers also meant NHS managers were struggling to check the safety and quality of care being provided. The government said an independent review of services would be published soon and it would act on that.
BBC News has found that a police officer who was a violent rapist passed vetting checks despite having two reports of criminal behaviour against women on his record. PC Alan Greer, who took his own life while under investigation, joined the police in Scotland in 2009, even though vetting staff were aware of his past. Our investigations correspondent Mark Daly has this report.
When PC Alan Greer was unmasked last month as a dangerous rapist with at least nine victims, Police Scotland insisted there'd been no missed opportunities over the years to identify his offending sooner. Now we can reveal that Greer was investigated by police in 2002 and again in 2005 for making inappropriate phone calls to women, with one case resulting in a formal police caution. He was accepted into what was then Strathclyde Police in 2009, despite force vetting staff being aware of his offending. Police Scotland has since said it provided answers to questions relating to Alan Greer's offending during the course of his policing career, and did not believe it had been answering questions about his police vetting records. It added that Greer would not pass vetting by today's standards.
The Ministry of Defence has confirmed that more than 1,000 retired service personnel are being pursued for debts because clerical errors meant they were paid too much pension. Many have contacted BBC News to say they're living in financial limbo and facing debts they didn't know they owed. The BBC's Your Voice correspondent Coletta Smith has the story.
Landing on the doormat of veterans across the country has been news their pensions have been overpaid, in some cases for many years. We've heard from people who've been sent bills ranging from £8,000 to £32,000. The government confirmed it was asking for repayment after four different financial errors led to overpayments totalling more than £5 million. It says it has a responsibility to recover taxpayer funds, but will always seek to do so in a proportionate way. The firms Sopra Steria and Equiniti, which run the pension scheme, say they've acted as quickly as possible and aren't responsible for the decision to recoup taxpayers' money. The veterans we've been in touch with are happy to now be paid the correct amount, but say they shouldn't have to repay money for an error that wasn't their fault and which many can't afford.
The Green Party of England and Wales has called on the government to slam the brakes on the development of new data centres because of the amount of water and energy they use. The centres have been treated as critical infrastructure since 2024, so planning permission is easier to get. Here's our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
Data centres often use large quantities of water to keep equipment cool. Companies in the UK are not required to report how much water they use, but demand is expected to grow. The Greens argue that with large parts of the UK in drought, the government should pause the approval of new sites. They say they should be subject to higher environmental standards. The Greens leader, Zach Polanski, said data centres should no longer automatically be considered critical infrastructure. The government, though, disagrees and says a pause would mean investment going abroad and the UK relying on overseas computing for sensitive data.
Actors including Hugh Bonneville, Nicola Coughlan and Matt Lucas are demanding greater legal protection from unauthorised AI clones of their voices. They've signed an open letter calling on the Prime Minister to give every person in the UK a legal right to their own voice. The government says it's consulting on ways to deal with unauthorised digital replicas while protecting legitimate innovation. A teenage girl has become the first person in the UK to be fitted with biodegradable implant to close a hole in her heart. Lily Yale, who's 14 and from Warrington, is a keen rugby player. And without the device, doctors said she might have to give up the sport. Our health reporter Jim Reid has more details.
When she was born, Lily Yale was diagnosed with a hole in the wall that divides the two upper chambers of her heart. It's now around the size of a 10-pence piece. Normally, a metal implant would be fitted to plug the hole and allow cells to grow over it. But a heavy impact would risk the implant being dislodged, ruling Lily out of rugby until she was fully healed. So instead, doctors at Alderhay Children's Hospital in Liverpool applied for a special licence to use a new device made from a biodegradable polymer, the same kind of material used in dissolvable stitches. Her mother told the BBC that after some early nerves, Lily was already back playing rugby for Warrington Girls just months after the operation.
Jim Reid reporting.
Thanks, Lisa. It's 9 minutes past seven, and some breaking news just coming into us now via Reuters is that officials in Nepal's Razua district have received a notice saying a lake has broken its banks and that rescue efforts are being paused for the next hour and 30 minutes. That's according to the Nepal Army. We'll bring you more on that as we get it, because across the front pages here and around the world this morning, there are harrowing stories of those missing after those devastating floods in Nepal and those searching desperately for any sign of life. Amid all that uncertainty, one certainty is that the death toll, currently at 469 in Nepal and 3 in Tibet, will rise. Well, before that breaking news about the lake, we spoke to Dr. Niti Srestar. She's an anaesthetist who has travelled to the district hospital in Razua to treat some of those who've been injured.
When we got here, they had already referred a few critical patients to Kathmandu through helicopter. And then we were only getting knocking patients, like few lacerated wounds, a few dressing. People who could walk away from the flood, like people who could climb trees and go on top of a roof or on top of a hill or something, so mostly healthy patients with very minor injuries. Many people have lost their loved ones, people they were trying to rescue but had to leave behind. People have run away from their homes just to save themselves without even their phone, with no slippers. Most of them are like covered in mud because it was like a mudslide. People have told me that they had to leave their elderly relatives behind because they couldn't carry them, or maybe if they couldn't walk or something, like elderly people. They had to see their family being washed away by the flood. There's no electricity, there's no mobile network. We've been using generators at the hospital, but even that has run out of fuel. So we came back to the hotel. In terms of resources, we have brought some emergency medication from the trauma center that we're going to leave behind here for them to use even after we leave, because all the roads are not accessible anymore. So the only way to come here is by air, and we are prioritizing taking people back and bringing food here. This is a district hospital, but it's very small. There are only 15 beds that are operational right now. It's more like the health post. We can only perform minor operations here. So for major cases, for serious patients that need higher center, we have been sending them to Kathmandu. The main problem with electricity, we have an extra machine. We don't have CT here. We had an extra machine, but even to use that, we had to use a lot of electricity, which has been difficult for us.
Well, a little early this morning, also before that breaking news about the lake bursting its banks, I spoke to David Fisher. He's the head of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's delegation in Nepal. He's in Kathmandu, and he told me about the work his team has been doing.
We're 2 days on from a very devastating flash flood that has struck Nepal. Most of the impacts have been in the northern part of the country, concentrating in the Rasuwa and Novakot districts. Although some have been felt all the way down into the southern part of the country because the wave has followed the entire length of a river basin. Villages have been wiped out. Many people are without homes. There's still a very urgent need for basic support. Unfortunately, there are still areas that are inaccessible except by helicopter. The authorities have been very busy trying to restore the roads, and they have indicated that they should be open very, very shortly. Nepal Red Cross has volunteers in these communities, and from their headquarters here in Kathmandu, they have been sending truckloads of relief items that have helped them to support people affected in the accessible areas so far, with food, safe water, with hygiene kits, and with other essentials, blankets and mattresses. But our biggest concerns, of course, are reaching those who have been inaccessible, and also the potential for a follow-up flood.
Well, tell me about that follow-up flood, because there is this suggestion that a lake of rising water that's formed along the Chinese-Nepal border could burst its banks. How devastating would that be to these communities who are already very severely affected?
It's a great concern. We don't yet have full visibility on the likely sort of force of a flood from this. But of course, this is not the first time, even with this disaster, that there has been an outburst flood in this area. And of course, every time it's a major event, and it's a danger to the same communities who have already been displaced, and of course, to the rescuers and to the workers who are trying to clear those roads.
Am I right in thinking that you're a little wary of sending in all of your emergency supplies to the area for fear that the flood could then take place and then you would have to send in more supplies again?
There's storage issues there. So we are sending them every day and disseminating them as quickly as we can. But yes, it's important that we make sure that both the people and the supplies are kept safe.
And when it comes to supplies, presumably you are still trying to get a sense, even from these inaccessible areas, of the true scale of what has actually taken place here.
That's right. So there's a common process of assessment, they call it the initial rapid assessment after disasters, that is usually carried out by the Nepal Red Cross together with local authorities and the police. And that is underway in Novakot, but not yet in Rasuwa.
And just finally, in the International Federation of the Red Cross appeal, you've talked about focusing on immediate humanitarian support, but also on supporting medium and longer term recovery. But presumably the situation is such that this is going to be an immediate humanitarian effort for quite some time before you move on to those later stages.
Of course, our first priority right now is the immediate basic needs. We need to make sure people have safe water, that they don't become ill, that they have food, that they have a place to stay that's safe for families, that's safe for children. But through this appeal, we want to make sure that we are not neglecting the healing and the recovery of these communities. Many of them have lost businesses. The trade route has now been cut again with China. And we hope that global solidarity will not be temporary and short term, but will help people get all the way back on their feet.
Okay, David Fisher from the Red Cross in Nepal, really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Just a bit more on that breaking news about a lake bursting its banks in the area. Nepal has now issued a warning for people to move to higher ground. They say that a dam upstream in Tibet is reported to have burst. That's a warning from police in Nepal in a statement. They say that all security personnel, rescue workers, and the general public deployed in rescue and relief operations are requested to remain alert and immediately move to a safe location.
It's 17 minutes past seven now. UEFA is planning to try and launch criminal proceedings against Gianni Infantino, the head of football's world governing body FIFA, after his aborted attempt to sell stakes in the World Cup to private companies. BBC Sport has seen documents that request evidence which UEFA could use in court. It is citing criminal mismanagement by Infantino himself over the whole affair. Well, we can speak to Nick DiMarco KC, sports barrister at Blackstone Chambers. Nick, good morning.
Good morning.
How would something like this work in practice?
Well, this is currently an application for disclosure in the American courts under Section 1782 of federal law. And what they have to show, what UEFA have to show, is that they have an arguable case to bring criminal proceedings, or for criminal proceedings to be brought against Infantino in Switzerland. And if they can show that, and I've read the papers as well, they're very thorough, they make a number of very serious allegations, then they ought to be given disclosure of a lot of the documents about what they describe as a secret plan to sell off FIFA's rights.
What is the likelihood that this could eventually go to trial and we would see all of this played out in court?
Well, I think we're a long way off from that. The first stage is this disclosure application. My own view is that the likelihood of success in that, which is very important, is high, is good. But then it's a question for the Swiss prosecutor, looking at all that disclosure, to decide whether there is a case under Swiss criminal law, and it's under a provision that deals with financial mismanagement, whether there is sufficient evidence to bring a case against Mr. Infantino and perhaps others under that. And that will take some time. And of course, it's a different threshold where it's a criminal trial. And so I think it's far too early to say whether it will ever go to a criminal trial in Switzerland. But I think what we will likely see is disclosure of very interesting documents and more light shone onto this plan.
Yeah. As you describe it there, Nick, it's reasonably complex. It would be expensive, no doubt. One wonders if rather than pursuing this with a hope of ultimate legal success, it's another part of UEFA's campaign where they talked about withdrawing from tournaments, but they've gone back on that. It's a way to get people talking and a way to increase the pressure, perhaps, instead.
Well, I think it's not necessarily a question of instead. I think it's probably all part of the same thing, as you say. This is both a political and a legal and a constitutional campaign, if you like, that it seems UEFA have embarked upon. They are very keen, it seems, from the papers, not only to stop this happening, when they did with others stop it happening, but to make sure people find out how it happened, why it happened, who was involved, and to get some kind of accountability to make sure this kind of thing cannot happen again. I think that's what UEFA wants, and this is all part of that strategy.
Yeah, to get that detail out there. Nick DiMarco, KC, from Blackstone Chambers, thank you.
At 20 past seven, Iran says it's drafting a list of conditions for reopening the Strait of Hormuz as part of peace talks. But despite the ongoing tensions, Kuwait and Qatar have reportedly managed to get oil shipments back to 70% of pre-conflict levels. Well, Theo Leggett's back to explain to us how.
Thanks very much, Henry. Yes, when hostilities broke out, the Strait of Hormuz was blocked and supplies of oil and other energy products from the Gulf were abruptly cut off, removing about a fifth of the world's supplies overnight. Global prices spiked, with the benchmark cost of Brent crude going from around $70 a barrel to more than $118 at one point. It's since come back down and it's now trading to about $88. And it seems some oil, at least, is getting through, and according to reports, up to 70% of the levels seen before the war. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Neil Atkinson, who's Senior Fellow at the National Centre for Energy Analytics. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning.
Neil, this is all very murky. It's clear that some oil is getting through, but we don't really know how much. What's your understanding?
It is murky, as you say, but the companies that specialise in tracking ship movements by satellite are suggesting that roughly 6 to 8 million barrels a day or so of crude oil has been passing through more recently, and that's heading towards about 50% of the volumes that we typically saw before the war. So there has been some improvement. Iran's ability to disrupt the shipping is less than it was. And ship owners are resorting to various methods, running their ships without using the satellite tracking systems, making a run for it in some cases, to all intents and purposes, moving smaller ships through the strait to be offloaded onto bigger ships outside the strait. So all sorts of creative measures are being adopted to try and improve the flows. But they are still not anything like the normal levels. And it's not just a question of the crude price.
Exactly. And we talk about crude, but what really matters here is refined products, isn't it? Things like kerosene for the aviation industry, liquefied natural gas, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And, crude oil in itself is useless. The value it has is how it can be turned into products, gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, and various other products. And these are essential. And the Middle East is a source of roughly 4 to 5 million barrels a day of product exports at normal times. Those exports are cut off. We're also seeing in Russia attacks by Ukraine on Russian refineries, which has cut off supplies or some supplies from Russia. So we're seeing a situation where the global refining industry is having to run flat out to provide the products that are needed to supply the global market. So, you talk about the crude oil price, roughly $90 a barrel for Brent right now. But in Europe, the price of a barrel of diesel has been close to $170 a barrel. So, you can see there already that prices like that for gasoline, for diesel, for jet and the other products, eventually that feeds through into inflation, that feeds through into higher costs for industry, which uses these products, and those costs eventually find their way through to the consumer.
Neil Atkinson, Senior Fellow at the National Centre for Energy Analytics, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Theo. It's 24 minutes past seven. A Musical Life of the Father of Modern Computing, Alan Turing, is to premiere across BBC Radio. The work's been composed by the Pet Shop Boys, and it was created as a memorial to the man who helped break Germany's wartime codes, but whose life ended after being convicted for homosexuality. David Sillitoe reports.
Oh, well, it smells like the 1940s. I wasn't expecting it to feel quite so authentic.
It's eerie.
Neil Tennant and Chris Lowe, the Pet Shop Boys, and a pilgrimage to Bletchley and the hut where Alan Turing worked, breaking codes during the Second World War.
Alan Turing dreamed of machines.
And the reason we're here is to talk about their musical life of Alan Turing, the father of modern computing, who in 1954 took his own life after being convicted for homosexuality. The story they first began working on some 15 years ago.
We were both struck by the appalling injustice of what had happened to him.
Personal side of the story that gripped us. It's such a tragic story, very moving.
I mean, thousands and thousands of lives were ruined. We haven't really, really dealt with that, I think, as a society.
I think I was on a beach in the south of France when I got your email. That's just absolutely, I couldn't believe it.
Professor Andrew Hodges, mathematician, Turing biographer, and here, honorary Pet Shop Boy.
Well, I was starstruck, of course, but obviously we got onto real collaboration.
We did,
And while they're used to big performances, this work had its first outing in an unexpected setting.
I happened somewhere to bump into a guy called Roger Wright, who was running Radio 3. And he said, what are the Pet Shop Boys doing? I said, well, we're writing this thing about Alan Turing. He said, but we must have it for the proms. Just like that.
And now, 12 years on, it's returning with a series of performances across BBC Radio. And with changing times, there's a nod to how a man whose openness about his life led him to disaster paved the way to today's technological frontier.
How many years? 12 years since we did it. And Andrew immediately said, what he calls so-called artificial intelligence. And we knew we had to deal with that because Alan had foreseen this.
Alan Turing's world has appeared, hasn't it?
Yes.
I think that's fair to say.
So that place over there, you could say, is like the birth of AI.
Yes.
It begins there.
Yeah, I was putting it into a more practical form, not just the theory about mind. It's exactly what we're doing.
I mean, this is a man who really struggled to tell a lie.
Yeah.
And the outcome is a technology that makes us doubt everything.
Generates fake news. And, the whole problem about AI is not that it's just so clever, which it is, but that it's interfering in everything.
And at the end, a final walk in the rain to the old stable yard where Alan Turing's theoretical work here began.
Before the Benedict Cumberbatch film came out, Alan Turing was known but not really, not a famous figure like he is, a famous great 20th century figure now. And we felt that more people should know about him. But I think we have a sense of his personality and thinking through writing the piece, definitely.
And standing here, eh?
No, it's really... I mean, this is a scene in the piece we've written. You know, this is... He would have walked through here. It's astonishing, really. And this is the first time we've been. Dreamed of machines.
That's just a flavour of it. If you're suitably intrigued, you'll be able to hear the full work on the 4th of October on BBC Radio 3 and on 6 Music.
Now at 28 minutes past seven, Mike's back with more sports news.
Hello again, Henry. England will resume day two of the second test with Pakistan later this morning on 248-9 at Lord's. You can follow day two with Test Match Special over on BBC Sounds from 10:30 this morning. In football, for the first time in 9 years, Rangers will play no European football this season after they lost their Europa Conference League playoff on penalties last night. Motherwell, Hibs and Larne are also all out. Brighton, though, have made it through to the league phase of the Conference League. We now, though, are going to talk athletics because we almost saw the longest standing world record in athletics broken last night at the Diamond League in Zurich.
Audrey Barrow kicking off the front. She's just too good. She's too fast. She's too strong. 2026 belongs to Audrey Barrow. Is she going to break the world record? Audrey Barrow, she doesn't. 153.71. What a great run from Audrey Barrow.
Yes, the European champion Audrey Vero came tantalisingly close to breaking a 43-year-old record in the women's 800 metres last night. Let's have a quick chat with the athletics journalist, Alex Seftel, who joins us. Hi, Alex.
Morning.
So she finished, didn't she, just 0.4 of a second off this long-standing world record. I mean, that was some race.
Oh, it certainly was. It's the race that's all the talk at the moment. And last night, the weather was warm and clear. It was a capacity crowd of 25,000 cheering on the Swiss athlete Vero in Zurich. You had pacemakers, you had bright flashing lights telling the audience and athletes what the world record pace was. So you thought that it was absolutely on. And Audrey Vero has made a 4-second improvement in her 800 meter time since the start of last year. But the record remains 153.28, set by Czech athlete Jarmila Kratovilova in 1983 in Munich. And Vero was already the first athlete to ever run a time within a second of that twice. And now she's done it three times at 153. And you've got to try every opportunity. She just didn't quite have enough at the finish.
Yeah.
She's only 22, though.
It could be a matter of just a matter of time, wouldn't it, until that record falls. Must mention Britain's Georgia Hunter-Bell as well, Alex, finishing third in that 800 metres with the season's best last night.
Yes, and Georgia Hunter-Bell, who has got three gold medals this year, World Indoor, Commonwealth Games and Europeans. She's got better and better since her international debut at the age of 30. Quite rare that, having spent time away from the track, which she excelled on as a schoolgirl. And yes, very close to breaking 154. I think her father, Andy, former Paris correspondent for Radio 4, of course, so known to this audience, but she really has grasped every opportunity. And many think that she's capable as well of chasing this world record. Yeah. And so that would mean that you have 5 of the 11 fastest women in history technically doing so, if you include, of course, Keely Hodgkinson, the Olympic champion, and Lillian Adira, the world champion of Kenya. And perhaps the next opportunity might be in Brussels, the Diamond League final there across the 4th and the 5th of September.
Not long to wait for those in a couple of weeks, I know. I've got to leave it there. Alex Seftal, athletics journalist, many thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
On BBC iPlayer.
There is a problem. A British contractor was shot in Svalbard up in the Arctic Circle.
Put down the gun!
This is DCI Silver.
I know who she is.
We have to keep things contained.
They go to war over this.
This is not the fight you can win.
The Russians are here, and it looks like they've come mob-handed.
Let's all stay calm. Okay, no one needs to get hurt. We need backup.
Amy, no!
The new series of Vigil starts on Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
Coming up just after 7:30, should there be a temporary ban on new data centres in England? The Greens are demanding one. We'll hear from both sides of the argument in the next few minutes.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Henry Zeffman in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And at 27 minutes to 8, Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
Officials in Nepal have suspended rescue operations because of fears of further flooding after buildings and homes were swept away by flash floods on Wednesday. Rescue teams searching for survivors have been told to leave the area and seek safety. Almost 470 people are now known to have died in northern Nepal, and hundreds are missing on both sides of the border. NHS bosses in England say the current model of autism and ADHD care is a bad deal for patients and taxpayers alike. The NHS Alliance says there's huge variation in what the health service is being charged for assessments and care. It warns that unregulated private providers are capitalising on the huge demand for help. BBC News has found that a police officer who was a violent rapist passed vetting checks despite having reports of criminal behaviour against women on his record. PC Alan Greer, who took his own life while under investigation, joined the police in Strathclyde in 2009. Vetting staff were aware he'd been investigated twice for making inappropriate phone calls to women. Police Scotland said Greer would not pass vetting by today's standards. The Ministry of Defence has confirmed more than 1,000 retired service personnel are being pursued for debts after clerical errors led to years of overpayments. Some veterans have contacted the BBC saying they've already seen money docked from their pension payments. The government says it has to recover taxpayer funds. The Green Party of England and Wales is calling on the government to pause the approval of new data centres as large parts of the UK experience drought conditions. The centres often use large quantities of water to keep computers cool. The government says the UK would miss out on jobs and investment if these projects were halted. Actors including Hugh Bonneville and Nicola Coughlan have signed an open letter calling for stronger laws to stop their voices being cloned by AI. They say everyone in the UK should have a legal right to their own voice. The government says it's consulting on ways to deal with unauthorised digital replicas while protecting legitimate innovation.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 25 to 8. There is a lot of controversy at the moment about the building of new data centres in the UK. Those in favour say that they are essential. If we're going to keep up with the tech boom and if we're reliant on that happening overseas, then it could ultimately compromise national security. Those against cite the environmental impact and the huge amount of water that they use to cool their equipment and ask, can that really be sustainable on a warming planet? Well, Louis, who lives in Berkshire, is worried about the environmental impact of a proposed data centre where he lives.
We're in the middle of a nature reserve and they're building a massive kind of glass housing thing. We don't really know what's happening in it. We don't really know how much like water is being used, what the noise is going to be. It's incredibly polluting for the local atmosphere and the local surroundings. I think it will just be really bothersome and quite disturbing. Like, if you're going to work, if you're going for a walk in the park, you'll see it, you'll be bothered by it. You'll think, what is this kind of weird thing doing there?
Well, that view is one that's shared by the Green Party. They want a temporary freeze on new data centres in England. So let's discuss this. Rachel Millward is with us, Deputy Leader of the Green Party, and Mark Acton, who's a data centre consultant and Executive Director of the Data Centre Alliance. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Rachel, we heard a little from Louis there about the impact on him living nearby. Just tell us what exactly it is that the Green Party is calling for here.
Well, look, we're in a situation at the moment where hundreds of vast scale data centres are being imposed on local communities honestly just for the benefit of UK tech giants. And they have an enormous impact in terms of water use and of energy use. They're basically wiping out and actually reversing a lot of the progress that we've made when it comes to the climate. The impact on local communities, as you've heard, is pretty horrendous. We're talking about temperatures raised in the local vicinity, a couple of degrees, even up to 9 degrees has been reported. You're talking about constant noise. And crucially, the development of data centres is getting priority over the development of essential housing. And then what's more is that because there's a blanket designation of data centres as critical infrastructure, they're getting priority access to our water and to energy over households, over public services, even over essential food production. The vast majority of the public do not think that is the right prioritisation. So what
okay,
we need
well
to
let, do... let's let Mark Acton respond to some of that. Mark?
Firstly, there aren't hundreds of new data centres being built. That's simply not true. Secondly, they're not using water. One of the problems we have in our sector is that people cite data from the US, and in the US they do have a problem. They do run roughshod over communities, and they do build very, very large data centers, which do consume a lot of water. That's the US, though. That is not the UK or indeed rest of Europe. We design data centers that actually don't use water specifically. We actually do a lot of the things the Green Party say. You know, in their notes in the press release, they talk about reusing brownfield sites. We do. We do not and never have taken water from local communities. That is simply not true. We actually don't use as much water as golf courses or leisure centres, if we actually look at the stats. So I think, you know, the big problem we have is that a lot of the data that we're having, that people are using, is absolutely invalid for the UK. I think what we need to do is have a proper debate using proper figures from the UK. And I'm sorry, but again, I'm going to repeat myself here. We are not building hundreds of new data centres, and they are not taking water from local communities. That is simply not true. So I think the rhetoric needs to be toned down.
That point about UK data is an interesting one, because companies in the UK are not required to report how much water they use. So it's difficult to know the exact amount. But Rachel Millwall, that policy suggestion that the Greens are making, is that based actually on data from a different country that, as Mark says, is not applicable here?
No, there are hundreds of data centres that are getting approval, that are being pushed through as a priority over essential housing. You're absolutely right. And it's a major problem. It's actually mind blowing if you think about it, the lack of scrutiny around the green lighting of these data centres. You wouldn't have that in any other sector. They need to be answerable to environmental impact assessments. We need accurate data on the water usage. We do have excellent research. There's a lot of that out there, which is suggesting it's incredibly high. And we do know that the energy use is so vast that they're in fact having to
I'm curious, Rachel, where your policy data has come from. If it's not from the UK, because as we said, the numbers are not there, and it's not from the US, what is it based on?
There is research. You can look at an organisation called Global Action Plan. There's a lot of research out there which is making clear this use. Of course, closed loop systems to cool down the data centres are preferable, but they actually use then higher energy. So we do know that we cannot possibly support the energy use of these data centres from what's on our grid. Hence, they're starting to develop their own independent gas supplies. And again, this is just riding roughshod over progress that we're making with climate. We need to pause. We need to do this in a smart way. We need AI sovereignty, and we need that to work for citizens. We need it to be sustainable. So we have smart, regenerative tech that can help this country have sovereign AI and a sustainable infrastructure into the future. This is happening in irresponsible pace without enough data. We're not considering carefully enough where these data centers need to go and how they are supported through energy. They don't have to be at massive scale. There is political choice at every level, and this can be done in a much more progressive, much more sustainable way that works for communities and not against them.
Mark Acton?
I just think basically nonsense. You know, that we engage with communities at every level. The reality is that getting planning provision for a data centre is very, very difficult. It's extremely difficult. The idea that the government are riding roughshod over this and using CNI to push through data centres is simply not true. I think Rachel Reeves has been involved in two decisions, both of which are still under appeal. So CNI is not pushing it through. Actually, in the sector, we'd love that CNI had more of an impact. It's having no impact, frankly. It's difficult even to get planning permission for data centers in the growth zones, the AI growth zones. And then Rachel is then talking about we want sovereign AI and you know, sovereign tech. That's true. We do. And I happily endorse that. But they need data centers. You've got to put it somewhere. You've got to, this stuff doesn't just sit in isolation in sort of an office basement somewhere. It's simply not true. And I think the other thing you need to consider is that data centers are not just AI. Data centers run our lives. You know, our phone, this call I'm on, WhatsApp is running through a data center. BBC iPlayer runs through a data center. The Green Party's website runs through a data center. Social media runs through a data center. Our banking systems run through a data center. You know, they are critical national infrastructure. What happens if we are no longer able to trade, either as businesses or as individuals? So our entire lives are based on digital technology, all of which sits in data centers. The idea that data centers holds data is nonsensical. We depend on these things massively now. And
it is a debate
without
that
them,
time is against us, but it is a debate. I'm sure this won't be the last time we hear this debate on the programme. But I thank you both for your input to it. Mark Acton, who's Executive Director of the Data Centre Alliance, and Rachel Millward, who's Deputy Leader of the Green Party.
17 minutes to 8. If I told you that football matches in a large part of Scotland have been suspended this weekend because of violence, threats and allegations of hate speech, you'd think that was pretty serious. You might also wonder why you hadn't heard about it already. Well, that's because those matches that have been suspended are played between 5 and 6-year-olds. Yes, the Scottish Youth Football Association has called off some of its matches in the Central Belt after incidents including an official being headbutted by an adult in front of children. Kyle Wilkie has coached for 17 years and runs an academy in Glasgow, which he started with his father and brother, and joins us this morning. Good morning, Kyle. Does this reflect what you experience?
Yes, good morning. It reflects the 17 years, and I think it's gradually got worse.
Is there a particular reason you felt it get worse?
I don't know if it's just because it's more recent in the memory, but yeah, it just seems to be a win-at-all-cost mentality, and there's a big stress and strain on kids playing football instead of it being an enjoyable sport for them.
So just give us a sense of some of the things that you've experienced.
Well, most recently, even last season, we had videos circulating of another coach, headbutting another coach. We've seen the same team in a mass brawl fighting. We reported it to say that we wouldn't be playing that team as we felt there were safeguarding issues when we played them. And because it was an ongoing investigation, we were forced to play them, but we still refused. But our club got fined. And
Your club got fined for refusing to play the team who you didn't feel safe playing?
Yes. So I think we got fined £100 a game. And that was us, I think, three times we didn't play them. And then it turned out the coach shouldn't have actually had his PVG, his disclosure, because he was found guilty for assault the year before.
Gosh. Well, the suspension that's taking place this weekend has never happened before. Is that something that you take as a sign that perhaps the authorities are now starting to take this as seriously as you'd like them to?
Yeah, I think so. It's a good first step, moving in the right direction, but it needs to be consistent. They need to have the governing body have officers at the game and reinforcing that these kind of behaviours can't be near the children, and they should just be turning up feeling safe and enjoying themselves at a bare minimum.
When you talk about the children feeling safe, it probably just does bear repeating again that this is generally, we're talking about adults misbehaving over kids' football here. I mean, do you, as an adult, as a very experienced former footballer and coach, do you ever fear for your safety when you're coaching football on a weekend?
Yes, you do. There's games you turn up to and you can't be bothered taking them just because of who you're playing against, how you know the atmosphere is going to be. And it's unfair because you should be looking forward to coaching the kids because the kids are brilliant. The kids are not to blame. It's the adults are the role models and they're not acting properly in front of the kids, and that's how they start acting out also.
And do you ever feel like it's dampening the enjoyment of football, which is presumably what you want these kids to get from it?
Yes, 100%. And I don't know if there's a pressure now of these kids to be football players. We treat kids 6, 7, 8, 9 as mini professionals instead of having a laugh and a joke and making it a calm, enjoyable learning environment for them.
All right, Carl Wilkie, football coach in Glasgow. Thank you very much for giving us your perspective this morning.
It's 13 minutes to 8. In just a few minutes' time, we'll hear a warning from NHS bosses that autism and ADHD services in England are at risk of descending into chaos. But before that, it is time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Catherine Pepinstep, Catholic commentator. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna. One of my favourite ever letters was one I received when I was editing The Tablet, the Catholic Weekly. It warmly invited me, if I were ever in Yorkshire, to visit the letter writer in his cave, for my correspondent was a hermit. Many people would think that eccentric, yet growing numbers of young people today are apparently embracing something that's called soft hermiting. It's a hashtag on TikTok, and according to a survey of 2,000 young people, a third of them had spent between 1 and 3 days without talking to somebody else. Soft hermiting, being a hermit for a short time, is about intentionally withdrawing from the world, cutting off contact with people and avoiding communicating at all. Its followers believe they're protecting their mental health. This is not just about getting rid of the chit-chat that's a normal part of life, but cutting off completely. Imagine, no negotiating with someone else over what and when to eat together, no discussing what to watch on TV, no chat about work, no arguments about politics, what to do at the weekend, no conversation about the latest novel or a football match, either in enveloping silence or scrolling on a phone. One newspaper writer described these young people's lives in their bedrooms or sailing along alone on their e-scooters as one of hermetic silence, as isolated as St. Simeon Stylites who lived on a pillar. But hermetic means tightly sealed, originating from Hermes Trismegistus, a character from ancient mythology, who created an impenetrable seal for glass. Nothing could get through the barrier. But that's not what being a hermit is about in the Christian tradition. The word hermit has Latin and Greek origins, meaning a person of the desert. While some of the earliest Christian writers, the Desert Fathers, went into the desert for peace and solitude, they shared their wisdom with others. Similarly, the 6th century St. Kevin of Glendalough might have had a life of such silence that legend has it a blackbird built a nest on his hand, but people still visited who wanted his guidance. My Yorkshire hermit was open to offering me hospitality and sharing his experience. The life of being alone in this tradition is one that benefits not just the individual, but the community. The young people experiencing soft hermiting this summer seem to want to be cut off from the world. That can be enriching, a moment to recharge the batteries, find time to think. What can be learnt from the Christian tradition, though, is not to be hermetically sealed away, but to leave the window of life still slightly ajar. Then, when you're ready, fling the shutters wide again.
That was Thought for the Day with Catherine Pepinster, Catholic commentator. It's 10 to 8.
How to manage the tension between supporting those seeking a diagnosis of autism or ADHD and overwhelming the health system. ADHD diagnoses in particular have soared in recent years, prompting the government to launch an independent review into rising demand for mental health, ADHD and autism services in England. That review will be published later this summer. But the warning this morning from the NHS Alliance, which represents health managers, is that the system as it stands risks descending into chaos, with both the taxpayer and patients who need support getting a bad deal. They're seeing sharp rises in costs, with the annual spend of one integrated care board jumping from £4 million a year to £30 million over the course of just 2 years. Well, in a moment, we'll speak to somebody affected by the flaws in this system. But first, delighted to be joined by Rebecca Gray, who's Director of Mental Health at the NHS Alliance, which represents health trusts and hospitals and has done this analysis, which is being published this morning. Give us a sense of the scale of this spending and how fast it's risen.
Good morning. Yes, you gave one example there in your introduction.
This is pretty consistent in terms of the challenge across the country at the moment. So we spoke to one integrated care board that had had an increase of moving from around £146,000 a month on assessments to £1.5 million, another spending around £11 million in the year 23-24, and estimating that by the end of this year they're likely to have spent £50 million within this year. So it's a very, very rapid increase, and that isn't that is obviously a cause for concern itself, but it feels like, to some extent, it's out of control. We're not seeing this de-accelerating in any way. And part of the drivers for that are is the system that we have to allocate patients to services, and the opportunity for a very wide range of providers to offer services directly to people if they...
Well, let's just unpack that, Rebecca Grace. So that's the right to choose, and what that means... Am I right in thinking that if people can't get seen quickly for ADHD or an autism diagnosis on the NHS, they have the ability to seek a private diagnosis, but it is paid for by the NHS, and the costs of that can be extremely variable, can't they?
They can. I mean, we had reports of a similar assessment costing anywhere between £300 and £3,000 to the NHS.
And the NHS has to pay regardless of the cost?
It has to pay if they, that's an organisation that has a contract for these assessment services. Some areas are introducing their own tariffs and ways of looking at managing costs. But what we're calling for today is a national approach to this, because it's the whole of the NHS making really tough decisions at the moment, and money spent in one area creates pressure elsewhere. And while it's really important for patients that we are able to get to see them as quickly as possible, and I think, you know, the health leaders I speak to feel very directly the frustration of adults and families of children who are seeking diagnosis or assessment for diagnosis and are waiting a long time. We do need to make sure that we're operating within a sensible national framework that helps us manage our expenditure and also concentrate on the models of assessment and care that are likely to deliver the best results for patients and get people seen quickly.
Well, just quickly, what does a sensible national framework look like to you? Do you want to end the right to choose? Do you want a guaranteed tariff of the maximum that an NHS trust might have to pay towards one of these private providers? What do you want that to look like?
So most of these cuts are being met by integrated care boards, who are the organisations often covering, you know, one or two counties or boroughs who meet these costs directly. Yes, we're asking for a national tariff, so that would be fixed prices for the same similar types of assessment, and those costs might go up and down depending how complex the challenges are related to the individual. And we're also asking for a national specification, so we're really clear what a good quality assessment looks like, and we can make sure that we have a good sense of the quality and consistency across the service. And there are great quality assessments both in the independent sector and in the NHS, but it's really hard for those paying for services to be completely assured of that at the moment.
Okay, Rebecca Gray, thank you very much from the NHS Alliance. Pleased to say we're also joined by Cheryl Fifield, who is an autism activist and posts on TikTok. Cheryl, tell us a bit about your personal experience of this assessment system, because you were diagnosed with autism in 2018, but you've been waiting, I think, for some time for an assessment on ADHD.
Yes, so I was diagnosed with autism in 2018 via the NHS pathway, and at that time I had to wait 2 years for my assessment, and I was only assessed for autism even though the provider that did my assessment could have done an ADHD assessment. I'm now several years older, and I am awaiting for an ADHD assessment, and recently I phoned up the NHS provider I've been referred to ask how long the waiting list is, as I've already been waiting 2 years. And they told me the wait list for them for an assessment is 4 years. And if I then got diagnosed to start medication, it would be 6 years.
Gosh.
Which just seems ridiculous, really.
Have you considered invoking the right to choose that we were just talking about there? So going to get a diagnosis at a private provider?
I have considered doing right to choose, but my GP practice themselves have concerns about the quality of these assessments, and they said that rather I get diagnosed via an NHS assessor. So it's really difficult because right to choose would mean I could get my assessment quicker, but equally my GP practice then have concerns about the care I would receive via a right to choose provider.
So essentially the GP has suggested that you would be better off waiting, even though it is a very long wait. I mean,
yes.
What do you think, having experienced the system in different ways over almost a decade now, what do you think is the thing that would particularly improve things for those like you waiting for an assessment?
I think, like they says, there needs to be guidance around what a good quality assessment is, and also a sense of urgency to figure this out. Obviously, I understand it's taking a lot of money from the NHS, but these diagnoses, my autism diagnosis especially, changed my life. It really helped me work on things that could help myself. It improved my mental health, all these different things. And I think that needs to be taken into account, because we're not waiting because we want a diagnosis. We're waiting because we need a diagnosis, because it's going to help benefit our lives.
Okay, Cheryl Fifield, autism activist, thank you very much for giving us your personal experience. And before that, we heard from Rebecca Gray, who's the Director of Mental Health at the NHS Alliance.
It's just a couple of minutes to eight. Let's hear details of this week's Any Questions Now. Coming up tonight at eight, here's Alex Forsyth. Morning, Alex.
Hello, good morning, Anna. Well, tonight we are in the hamlet of Tully Nestle in rural Aberdeenshire, which could be interesting in the week of the latest energy price cap and with renewed debate about energy security and supply. On our panel, we have Hannah Mary Goodlad, the Minister for Public Finance in the Scottish Government. Annalise Dodds is a Labour MP and former UK Government Minister. Jeff Aberdeen is a political strategist and former Chief of Staff to Alex Salmond. And Magnus Linklater is a columnist at The Times and the paper's former Scotland editor. We will be live at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4. Hope you can join us.
Thanks, Alex. Sounds fascinating. And at 2 minutes to eight, it is time for the weather again. Here is Ben Rich. I'm not sure we do have Ben Rich. So just to give a bit of a sense of what's coming up in the 8 hour, we are going to hear more about what is happening in Nepal and also an interview with a NASA scientist about the new Super Special Space Telescope, which is being launched later this weekend from Florida.
Yeah, the situation in Nepal is an interesting one. We'll catch up with our China correspondent, Laura Bicker, because about an hour ago, there was this warning that we brought you that a dam had apparently burst in Tibet. That had come from police in Nepal. It seems now the situation not quite as critical as that. What they're saying is there was a mistranslation of a certain word. So while the dam is leaking, it is yet to fully break its banks. But we'll speak to Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, who will bring us the latest on that. And also before nine, we will discuss some of those broader questions about how and why this happened and whether or not the impact of climate change, particularly on places like the Himalayas, will mean that the threat of natural disasters on a scale like we've seen here might increase in the future. We'll speak to a climate expert on that and really look at this story in the round before 9 o'clock this morning on the programme.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 28th of August. The headlines this morning. Nepal and China have both suspended rescue operations after Wednesday's deadly flash floods on their border because of fears of more flooding. We'll hear from families desperately seeking loved ones and explore the impact of climate change on some of the world's least developed nations. NHS managers say the cost of dealing with autism and ADHD is spiralling out of control, with private providers taking advantage of the huge demand for help. And King Harald of Norway, Europe's oldest monarch, has died at the age of 89.
Also in the next hour, Hubble, James Webb and now NASA's Nancy Grace Roman. There is a new super powerful space telescope on the block.
We're going to be surveying billions and billions of items, galaxies, stars, etc. That means we're going to be finding thousands of one in a million type items. We don't know what we're going to discover, and that's what's probably the most exciting.
And
I guess they know we're coming.
Yep.
What have you gotten yourselves into?
That is one of the most anticipated games of the year, Grand Theft Auto 6. It's had its big reveal, well, its preview, at least. You can't play it until November, but we'll find out how it's gone down with gamers who've been waiting for years for it. Before all of that, the BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
2 days after a devastating flash flood in Nepal, rescue efforts have been paused because of fears about further flooding. Local officials warned people to move to higher ground, with reports suggesting that a dam upstream was overflowing. About 470 people are known to have died in Wednesday's flooding. Hundreds of others are still missing, including 33 British nationals. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri sent this report from one of the worst affected areas.
Roads are caked in mud in Trishuli, with some vehicles half buried. Police barricades block off entry to some of the worst affected areas near the riverbeds, with warnings of more possible flooding to come. The casualty figures continue to rise in what has become the worst disaster Nepal has seen since an earthquake in 2015. This time, experts believe a glacier collapsing could have triggered flooding. Helicopters are still flying over the mountains, searching for survivors and delivering relief supplies. Hundreds of people have been rescued, including most of the 450 people trapped in a tunnel in Trishuli. Moments like these offer hope to the families we meet who are desperately waiting for news of their loved ones.
On the other side of the border in Tibet, the rescue operations by Chinese authorities has also been suspended. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker is monitoring developments from Beijing.
A lake formed by a landslide on the Nepal-China border has started to overflow, according to reports in Chinese state media. Experts in Tibet have been flying drones and mapping out the lake near Girong Port, the main land border between the two countries that was washed away in a torrent of mud and water. They're concerned that heavy rainfall in coming days may cause further flooding downstream. Rescuers in the area have been told to suspend operations for now. There is no indication in the Chinese media reports that the lake has burst its banks, but water has started to flow downstream.
Dr. Niti Shrestha is an anaesthetist who's been helping to treat wounded patients in Rasuwa district.
Many people have lost their loved ones, people they were trying to rescue but had to leave behind. People have run away from their homes just to save themselves without even their phones. Most of them are like covered in mud because it was like a mudslide. People have told me that they had to leave their elderly relatives behind because they couldn't carry them, or maybe if they couldn't walk or something. They had to see their family being washed away by the flood.
NHS bosses are warning autism and ADHD care in England is at risk of descending into chaos, with spiralling costs and unregulated private providers capitalising on the huge demand. The NHS Alliance, which represents health managers, said the current system was a bad deal for patients and taxpayers alike. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
People needing assessments and care for autism and ADHD can choose to be seen by either NHS services or private firms and charities. The policy is designed to help patients in England bypass long waiting lists. But with demand increasing, the NHS Alliance said it had come at a cost, with some local health boards reporting a tenfold increase in spending. This was partly being driven by a huge variation in charges. In one case, the NHS was paying between £300 and £3,000 for similar services. A rapid increase in the number of providers also meant NHS managers were struggling to check the safety and quality of care being provided. The government said an independent review of services would be published soon and it would act on that.
BBC News has found that a police officer who was a violent rapist passed vetting checks despite having two reports of criminal behaviour against women on his record. PC Alan Greer, who took his own life while under investigation, joined the police in Scotland in 2009, even though vetting staff were aware of his past. Our investigations correspondent Mark Daly has this report.
When PC Alan Greer was unmasked last month as a dangerous rapist with at least 9 victims, Police Scotland insisted there had been no missed opportunities over the years to identify his offending sooner. Now we can reveal that Greer was investigated by police in 2002 and again in 2005 for making inappropriate phone calls to women, with one case resulting in a formal police caution. He was accepted into what was then Strathclyde Police in 2009, despite force vetting staff being aware of his offending. Police Scotland has since said it provided answers to questions relating to Alan Greer's offending during the course of his policing career, and did not believe it had been answering questions about his police vetting record. It added that Greer would not pass vetting by today's standards.
The Ministry of Defence has confirmed to the BBC that more than 1,000 retired service personnel are being pursued for debts because their pensions were overpaid in error. Some people have been sent bills ranging from £8,000 to £32,000. Hundreds of veterans have already begun to see their pensions docked. The MOD says it has a responsibility to recover taxpayer funds. Major General Neil Marshall is the Chief Executive of the Forces Pension Society, an independent watchdog for veterans. He told us the government should recoup the funds elsewhere.
Veterans have spent their entire military career sort of trusting authority and understanding it with responsibility becomes accountability. And the irony here is that they are now being held accountable for the Ministry of Defence and the contractors' errors. So the impact is profound.
An official report has found that universities in Scotland are facing an acute and growing financial crisis. The analysis, carried out on behalf of the Scottish Government and higher education institutions, warns of an annual gap between income and spending of £200 million, which could widen further because of falling numbers of foreign students. Our Scotland editor, James Cook, reports.
Scottish undergraduates do not pay tuition fees in Scottish universities, but this report says declining public funding since 2016 means that policy is increasingly subsidised by fee-paying international students. Their numbers have now dropped, it says, with immediate and severe consequences. The report sets out other pressures too, including rising costs of energy, national insurance and red tape. The Scottish Government defends what it calls free tuition, but says it accepts changes needed to ensure a sustainable funding model for the sector.
In the past hour, the death has been announced of Europe's oldest reigning monarch, King Harald V of Norway. He was 89 and had been in poor health for many years. King Harald came to the throne in 1991. Daniel Sanford looks back at his life.
Scene of a royal wedding, a love story with troubled beginnings which ended...
As a young prince, Harald became the first future Norwegian king to marry a commoner, his beloved Sonja, who he dated secretly for almost a decade.
He told his father, King Olav, she was the only woman he would marry.
He was part of the Scandinavian tradition of royals living a relatively unassuming life. 10 years ago, he celebrated his silver jubilee with a skiing party outside the palace. In recent years, the family of his son, the Crown Prince Håkon, had been tainted by scandal. First, his wife, Crown Princess Mette Marit, had to apologise for her friendship with Jeffrey Epstein, and then her son from a previous relationship, Marius Borg Høiby, was convicted of rape. Now, Crown Prince Håkon will become King Håkon, bringing the scandals even closer to the throne.
A musical life of the father of modern computing, Alan Turing, is to be premiered across BBC Radio. The work, composed by the Pet Shop Boys, was created as a memorial to the man who helped break Germany's wartime codes, but whose life ended after being convicted for homosexuality. Our arts correspondent David Sillitoe has been listening to it.
The work takes in Alan Turing's life as a codebreaker, a pioneer of computing, dreamed of machines, and his suicide in the months after he was convicted for homosexuality. A life story that both inspired and horrified the Pet Shop Boys. They began working on this project some 15 years ago. An early version was performed at the Proms, but has now been revised for a broadcast premiere on Six Music and Radio 3 in October. And over its development, much has happened, including an official pardon for Alan Turing and the emergence of his dream of a universal machine, artificial intelligence.
David Sillitoe reporting.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 10 minutes past eight. The scenes of devastation in Nepal, where approaching 500 people are now confirmed dead after flash floods, are hard to comprehend. thick brown mud topped with a layer of debris and rubble, bodies floating within, the jagged remains of buildings ripped from their foundations littering the riverbanks. And rescuers are working at risk of being swept away themselves, with a newly formed lake in danger of overflowing. In China-controlled Tibet, state media says that risk is so great that it's stopped the recovery work altogether. Hundreds more people are still missing on both sides of the border, including more than 30 British tourists. Well, let's speak to our China correspondent, Laura Bicker, who is monitoring developments from Beijing. Laura, there was some discussion, some debate about whether or not a dam had burst. That appears, as we were saying, to have been a mistranslation. But what is the latest situation there?
So let's start with this lake. This lake has formed within the debris of the landslide that happened on Wednesday. Now, you might remember the footage of Giryong Port. This is the land border between Nepal and Tibet that was swept away in that torrent of mud and water. You'll remember the pictures. Now, since then, obviously, it's been a real challenge for rescuers in China to get nearby. What they've been doing is flying helicopters over this valley. And in the midst of that, they spotted this lake, that water was rising in amongst the rubble. So really, it's a kind of a lake that is formed within the landslide itself. Now, officials in China have been monitoring it. They've been using 3D mapping to get an idea. And then what happened is they put out an alert saying they feared that within the next few days, it could overflow. And it did start, water did start to flow out of it. Rescue operations on the Tibetan side were halted. Now, that seems to have been an alert that's been issued right across the border and into Nepal. What I can tell you is the latest we have, according to Chinese state media, remember, everything I do has to be reported through Chinese state media because I can't go to Tibet, but they're telling us that the water level of that lake has now dropped and that rescue operations are getting back underway. So it does seem that that fear right now has subsided, but it still exists.
Yeah, and as you were describing there, Laura, not just the danger from that lake, but as a rescue operation as a whole, as you said, what you are seeing through state media, it highlights really some of the challenges that people are facing, trying to find survivors, if there are any, trying to recover bodies. There's a lot that they're trying to deal with.
I mean, I think when it comes to this kind of operation, China is very well placed because it has really cutting edge technical equipment to map out, to x-ray the land, to try to find survivors. This area is prone to really serious earthquakes and the teams there are used to responding very, very quickly. However, even for the Chinese side, including the People's Liberation Army and the Air Force, they're finding it a major challenge. They did manage to get a couple of hundred rescuers near that port that has become the centre of a real issue here in China, but they haven't managed to get major teams in. And now, of course, rescue operations over the last few hours have been suspended. I think I should explain to your listeners that if they don't already know, when it comes to Tibet, really it is one of the most carefully controlled parts of China. It is one of the most heavily restricted parts of China. And as a foreigner and as a member of the foreign press, I cannot travel there. So every single bit of information I am giving you, I'm relying on Chinese state media. I can't go there to independently verify it. It's also incredibly politically sensitive. Remember, this is an area that has long pleaded for more autonomy. So President Xi himself has been issuing these instructions, these top-down instructions, to make sure that all-out efforts are made for the rescue teams. But when it comes to this lake, they're being extremely cautious because the last thing they want is for it to overflow, for the banks to burst and rescuers be washed away.
Thank you, Laura. Laura Bicker there, monitoring the situation in Tibet, as she described, from Beijing. Different situation in Nepal. We are able to get closer to the devastation on that side. And our correspondent, Fanindra Dahal, is in Trishuli in Nepal and described how people there are struggling.
Many people are still trying to find the whereabouts of their missing relatives. They want to know whether they are alive or even if they have lost their life, they want to get some kind of closure. The damage is catastrophic. A district is completely disconnected by road. Those who survived from this disaster, they told us that they feel lucky. But those who have lost their loved ones are grieving. People just say that, why us? We have to go through this.
And among those questions that people are asking more broadly is about why and how this happened, and if the impact of climate change will mean that the threat of natural disasters on the scale that we're seeing here is likely to increase in the future. And that is something we'll discuss on the programme before nine. Let's speak to Rajendra Pudaseni, whose childhood friend Sarada Simkada, who's a nurse from Dartford, is missing at the moment. His godson, some of his wife's family who live in Nepal, are also out of contact at the moment and have been since this happened. He's a president of the Non-Resident Nepali Association here in the UK. Rajendra, I thank you for joining us. I know it's a difficult time for you, and one of the hardest things that you're having to deal with is just that difficulty in communication, just not being able to reach anybody.
Yeah, I've been in touch with my family now because my mom and my nephew's children, just newly born, 1.5 months, were rescued yesterday night by the army. And just heard a few minutes ago that another wave of flood with the mud coming again, and there are already scaremongering going on. People have started to run away from the plain land up to the hills. And situation is so catastrophic and so alarming that, you know, the Nepal every decade has to face this kind of human catastrophes. So it's really, really hard situation. We can't do nothing about it from here, far away from home, trying to raise some money and communicate to the family, trying to trace out who has been missing and trying to find out what is happening there and communicating each other within our society. So it's really, really a hard situation for us now to bear and to even communicate.
Yeah, as you were saying, and just that need and want to help and do something. You did say that you've managed to get through to your wife's family now. You described them them being rescued. What did they tell you about that?
My wife's family, the uncle and auntie and one of their granddaughter and her husband, they died because people witnessed that. And along with them, other like neighbors, they swept away with all the villages, you know, they were residing. And my godson, we found the body yesterday morning. You know, he just buried under the mud at his house. And yes, lots of other you know, dead bodies being found. It started to smell. And lots of worries about communicable diseases starting very soon. So, yes, it's very difficult situation to describe, actually.
Yeah, it is. And how are you managing to, because I'm sure you're trying to, even at this distressing moment, support other members of the community here who, like you describe, are so far away and unable to help or do anything.
Yeah, we have our rescue team from Non-Resident Nepali Association head office in Kathmandu. They have been in touch with the local villages to the extent how, you know, and wherever they can, they could possibly go. Because there is no infrastructure left, all the bridges gone and the roads gone. So they have managed to reach to the area they could, and they're working in close ties with the army and using helicopters to send the emergency medicine and emergency food supplies to the affected areas.
People are obviously trying their very, very best in that area to help with those rescue and recovery operations. But from the way it's described, and as you said, there's so much of the infrastructure washed away. Is there any sense that not enough had been done prior to this to try and make things safer for people in that area?
Because of the geographical situation, the valley is very narrow where the Trisuli River comes from. And even though they had the warning just before the flood came, and people didn't have anywhere to go because they didn't have escape route. Basically, they were in the riverbank, and the amount of the flash flood was so high, they couldn't even run, even if they wanted to run. Some people, luckily, when they found the upway to the mountains, to just run and climb up. So they saved their life. Otherwise, the school children traveling in a bus, and some pilgrimage people, you know, travelers, they were traveling in a car or in a vehicle. They all swept away. They didn't have any chance to escape because of the geographical situation.
I understand. And as you say, it just offers no route of escape, really, does it, when you have those narrow valleys? And you talked about losing your family, Rajendra, for which we send you our condolences. And we mentioned as well your friend Sarada. Have you heard anything about Sarada?
Sarada, we have not heard anything. Apparently, Sarada was waiting for her visa to go to China, Mount Kailas in Mount Sarovar Lake. And she was residing in Hotel Kailas. And apparently the Kailas Hotel was badly damaged as well. So she was in a group, and we haven't heard anything from that group. We are talking to the rescuers, the armies, and the authorities of the Nepalese local government and local people's network. And we haven't heard anything as yet. She's a wise nurse, very humble person, and very, very active community member. She would have informed at least us, the family, about her whereabouts if she would have, managed to get any connectivity, any signs of communication. So we are still hoping she will call us and she comes back. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
I knew Sarah a long time ago when we were, going to school together in Nepal.
Yeah. And as you say, so much of the difficulty at the moment is just that feeling of waiting, as you said, waiting and hoping that the phone rings, hoping that there's a call to hear that she and others are okay.
And the very affected area where the flash flood started, it's really, really hard to get there with the transportation link. Even helicopters are struggling to go there frequently. It's very far to the Chinese border. Is quite a way from our area. So it's really, really difficult, and I wonder how the rescue workers have been trying to reach there. It's so difficult now. It's too early to say what is happening in there.
Yeah, difficult, as you say, for the people involved and for people like you waiting for news as well. Rajendra, thank you for joining us. Rajendra Pudaseni, who is. Was describing there, has family in the area, his childhood friend, also the president of the Non-Resident Nepali Association here in the UK.
Yes, very powerful that, Anna. It's 23 minutes past eight, and early on Sunday morning, a Falcon Heavy rocket will launch from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, carrying with it NASA's next great observatory, the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, a $4.3 billion instrument built to confront some of the deepest questions in astrophysics, including why exactly the cosmos itself is flying apart at an accelerating rate. Now, the Roman is much stronger than the space telescopes that have come before it. It can capture an area of sky at least 100 times larger than the Hubble telescope. And in just 4 months, it should beam back as much scientific data as Hubble accumulated during its first 30 years in orbit. We'll ask NASA's Bear Witherspoon, who's part of the launch team, about Nancy Grace Roman herself and why her name has been given to this telescope.
She had the outlandish idea of putting space telescopes in space, so you didn't have to look through the atmosphere, which for people who work in this industry now, it just sort of seems like a given, but without Nancy Grace Roman, Dr. Roman, that would not be true. So her legacy is quite something, and we're all very thankful to her. But also, it's lovely to be her namesake, right? Space telescope about to launch on Sunday morning.
Well, speaking of space telescopes that are in space, I think people will have heard of Hubble, mm-hmm. perhaps of James Webb, which went up into space just a few years ago. Why is this telescope different to those ones that came before?
The big thing that we're bringing is in a massive field of view. All those other telescopes before, Webb and Hubble, have smaller fields of view. So what that means is we can survey large swaths of the sky and do it repeatedly and pull down loads and loads of data and then give it to the world so that data can be easily farmed and people can all look for things that they're interested in. Previously, astronomy was done in a way where you would ask someone to point a space telescope at a specific thing that you're interested in. This is going to help redefine the way it is done. So if you have interest in something that we show you with Roman, you can go back and look at it using different tools.
I guess to draw a crude analogy with a camera phone, perhaps, or a camera,
And obviously, sure, we're speaking in relative terms here because these are all vast, unimaginably vast distances we're talking about. But essentially, this new telescope can take sort of panoramic photos rather than specific portraits.
That's exactly it. To give an idea, so our nearest neighbor galaxy is called Andromeda, right? And so Hubble did a survey of that Andromeda galaxy, piecing together lots of images because it has a smaller field of view, right? It took it 3 years to do that. We're just going to do that in like three different images, I think. It's like three or four images, and we've already covered Andromeda. So that gives an idea, just like you said, wide field of view versus sort of a more focused pinpoint.
Because you mentioned the Andromeda galaxy. One of the other things that this new telescope is going to do, the Nancy Grace Roman, is a more detailed survey. I think the most detailed survey yet of our galaxy, of the Milky Way. What is there that we still don't know, that we still need to know, that you crave knowing at NASA about the Milky Way?
Well, that's a great question. One of the things that we're going to be doing of the Milky Way is a demographic census of the planets in it, right? So we don't know what our neighborhood looks like in terms of size of planets, distance from their stars. We know a lot about our solar system, but we're just adding more to that catalog of exoplanets is what they're called. So doing a census essentially of the Milky Way to tell us how many Earths are there, how many Jupiters, how many other types of planets are in there. That's one of the big things. There's a lot more to it, but like we like to say that we're going to be surveying billions and billions of items, right? Be the galaxies, stars, etc. That means we're going to be finding thousands of one in a million type items. So a lot of this is, we don't know what we're going to discover. And that's what's probably the most exciting thing.
And just finally, we began this conversation talking about Nancy Grace Roman, NASA's first chief of astronomy, after whom this telescope's named. She died in 2018. What do you think she would have made of the sorts of scientific discoveries that you hope that her namesake telescope will be making within weeks and months?
Oh, I mean, I can only imagine that she would be unbelievably thrilled. There's this one image that I think of. She was always a huge advocate for passing on information and knowledge spreading and advocacy for especially women in science. But there's a great photo of her looking through a window at the primary mirror of the James Webb Space Telescope, that big hexagonal, beautiful thing, right? And talking to the chief astronomer for that mission, right? And I just always advocating, always trying to be in there even when she was retired, right? So that image is from 2017, right? Before she passed in 2018. And I get choked up when I see that. So I can only imagine how thrilled she would be to be on the cusp of so much acceleration of discovery.
Well, it's happening on Sunday. Bear Witherspoon, good luck with the launch. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for chatting with me. And go Roman. Thanks.
That was Bear Witherspoon from NASA there. And at 29 minutes past eight, Mike Williams is back with more sport.
Hello again, Henry. Let's get more, shall we now, on the future of Gianni Infantino. It has been a month since the FIFA president's controversial plan to sell off stakes in the World Cup and other competitions was hastily scrapped following widespread opposition. But as we know, calls for Infantino to go have only grown louder. We mentioned last hour that UEFA is preparing criminal legal proceedings against FIFA, accusing them of, quote, criminal mismanagement. Well, many of the top figures in UEFA were in Monaco for a meeting yesterday. One of them is the head of the Norwegian FA, Lise Klaveness. She, along with the association she leads, has become one of the leading critics of Gianni Infantino.
Infantino is polarizing the world in a way we haven't seen in history. That's why leadership is important. So for now, it's not a quick fix, but we have to stay. We cannot be what we criticize. We cannot boycott to pressure out a legally elected president. Then we'll become what we criticize. So now we have to, you know, find the balance between using energy in the here and now and the momentum, but also have endurance to really see that this has been an issue over many, many years.
That is Lise Klaveness, head of the Norwegian FA, speaking to the BBC yesterday. Well, the BBC's football issues correspondent, Dale Johnson, is still in Monaco after that meeting yesterday, joins us on the programme now. Hi, Dale.
Hi there, Mike.
So leaving aside the threat of legal action, which we discussed in the last hour of the programme, just give us an overview of where UEFA go from here, do you think? Are they seriously now sounding out candidates to try and run against Infantino in the presidential election next year?
Yeah, so UEFA issued a very lengthy statement after the Congress meeting in Monaco yesterday afternoon. And one of the things they underlined there was they are going to try and find a candidate that can unify world football to try and find if they can get to the 106 votes they need to get to in the FIFA presidential election next March to enable to overthrow Gianni Infantino as FIFA president. Now, that just seems very difficult right now. We've got Victor Montagliani, who is the president of CONCACAF, which is North America. He looks like a likely candidate. But still, it's still not certain that he's going to be the kind of candidate that can get this over the line, because there is still a lot of support around the world for Infantino.
Yeah, they've got until mid-November, I think, haven't they, the deadline to declare a candidate for that presidential election. Well, just on Infantino, what's his next move? Because it is, as you say, worth remembering he does retain his own sizable base of support.
Well, ever since he withdrew the FIFA Forward Enterprise proposal for private equity in FIFA's competitions, he really has been continuing as business as usual. He's been to Colombia to the inauguration of a new president. He was in the Caribbean at the weekend for a youth tournament that was being funded by FIFA. So he thinks that his position is fine and he's got no questions to answer. Now, the real thing that UEFA are saying is for this FIFA Forward Enterprise, it needs to be an independent review about what happened, who knew what, and if there was any type of tender went out for it. It should not be a FIFA management board review. It has to be independent. Yeah. And there needs to be these answers so that so world football can be confident that there was no wrongdoing involved.
We have not heard the last of this. We can all be sure of that. Many thanks for that fly from Monaco this morning, football issues correspondent Dale Johnson. And just to say, England will resume day two of the second test with Pakistan later this morning on 248 for 9 at Lord's. Follow day two with Test Match Special from 10:30 over on BBC Sounds.
Thank you, Mike. Coming up in half an hour, it is The Reunion with Kirsty Walk.
In 1969, three brothers with little experience of music promotion managed to convince Bob Dylan into headlining a music festival on the Isle of Wight. The next year, they assembled probably the greatest lineup of all time: Jimi Hendrix, Joni Mitchell, The Doors. 600,000 fans came, but it descended into chaos and bankrupted the organisers. Among British bands, Pentango, Jethro Tull and the Moody Blues were there, and their respective lead singers, Jackie McShee, Ian Anderson and Justin Hayward join us, and two of the brothers, for the reunion, this morning at 9 o'clock.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Henry Zeffman in London. It's 27 minutes to 9, and now a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
Rescue efforts in Nepal and Tibet have been suspended as fears grow that a lake upstream from Wednesday's flash floods could burst its banks and cause more flooding. Police in Nepal say 475 people are now known to have died and hundreds are still missing on both sides of the border, including 33 Britons. NHS managers are warning the cost of autism and ADHD care in England is spiralling out of control. The NHS Alliance says some local health boards have reported a tenfold increase in spending. The government says an independent review of services will be published soon, which it will act on. A number of military veterans have contacted BBC News, saying they're in financial limbo after being told their pensions have been overpaid due to clerical errors. The Ministry of Defence has confirmed more than 1,000 retired service personnel are being pursued for debts. The government says it has to recover taxpayer funds. Europe's oldest reigning monarch, Norway's King Harald, has died at the age of 89. He was taken to hospital last week for treatment for a rare blood condition.
Thank you, Lisa. It's just coming round to 25 to 9 now. The devastating flash floods in Nepal and Tibet, which have killed hundreds of people, are raising even as a huge rescue and recovery effort goes on. Serious questions about how and why it happened, and if the impact of climate change will mean that the threat of natural disasters on this scale increases in the future, and specifically are countries like Nepal, for example, being disproportionately hit when they contribute so little in terms of emissions but are bearing the brunt of the problems they cause? Well, Tom Rivett-Carnac is with us, former head of political strategy at the UN, co-host of the Outrage and Optimism podcast, and Sarav Malhotra is managing director for South Asia at Conservation International and is speaking to us from New Delhi. Good morning, both. Tom, first of all, what are your thoughts on that? What feels like quite a pertinent question on a day like today.
Yeah, and your reporting earlier from Rajendra was heartbreaking when we hear the stories on the ground and what this means on a human scale. I mean, it's certainly true that climate change is a fundamentally unfair phenomena. It is economically unfair, it's geographically unfair, it's generationally unfair. And what we're seeing here is countries that have done so little to cause these issues that are now right at the front line of all of these impacts. And, you know, as we've seen, the central and eastern Himalayas have now lost 20% of their ice coverage. That is leading to real instabilities in the mountainsides. And there are millions of people that live downstream of these valleys. And we hope we can put in place early warning systems that prevent these sorts of impacts becoming a regular event. But right now, that looks like a hard task.
And Sarav, when we look at the figures on this, so for example, the International Energy Agency says that 0.08 of global CO2 emissions in 2025 came from Nepal. But then when you look at the Copernicus Climate Change Atlas, which is the climate service of the European Commission, Nepal is the fourth most at-risk country in the world to the impact of climate change. So what can be done to try and strengthen, as Tom was talking about there, things like early warning systems, things like adaptation and resilience in places like that?
Yes, absolutely. I think, Anna, what Nepal is showing us right now is a much, much bigger story about the Himalayas, about South Asia and the global South in general. Like you mentioned, this is one of the most climate vulnerable regions in the world. From the high mountains through the great river systems down to the plains and the deltas, hundreds of millions, actually billions of people depend on these landscapes for water, for food, agriculture, and ultimately for livelihoods. Many of these systems are changing right now. We're seeing warmer temperatures. We're seeing extreme change in rainfall patterns, melting glaciers, like Tom just mentioned, increasingly unpredictable water flows, and many, many more extreme weather events. And when you combine all of this with the terrain of the Himalayas, with rapidly growing communities, you get catastrophic consequences very, very quickly. In terms of what needs to happen, there isn't really one silver bullet. I think what we know clearly is that we need nature. We need nature to be restored, and we need infrastructure. We need to be able to restore forests and watersheds, because healthy landscapes can slow down water, can hold soil together, can reduce erosion and help communities become more resilient. We also need to protect our wetlands and our river systems, restore degraded land, and really begin to think about entire watersheds rather than individual towns or cities or projects, right? But equally, there are places where you really need to build bridges, build roads, build drainage and protective structure and other forms of resilient infrastructure. And of course, we need much, much better early warning systems so people have a chance to move before the water arrives. And I think the important thing here is to stop thinking about these as competing approaches, and that nature-based solutions and well-designed grey infrastructure need to work together, and then we need to be able to scale this.
What about, Tom, some of the responsibility for doing that? Because when we talk about these countries in the global south, they often don't have the excess cash sitting around to invest in things like this, which are, of course, important when it comes to the protection of the population. But they've got lots of competing pressures on their budgets. Should it be down to countries who are more responsible for producing those emissions to help those who are feeling the impact of it?
Well, so first of all, I completely agree with Sarav's comments, particularly around restoration of nature in these places. And the force of the argument that you just pointed to is completely irresistible. I mean, this has been caused by one group of countries who are then leaving much of the rest of the world to face this without the support that they need in order to actually take the steps to deal with it. So absolutely, that should be the responsibility of countries that have caused this problem. We're living at a time where we're seeing development budgets slashed, international responsibility eroded, and we need to change that if we're going to actually be able to collectively deal with this issue and meet our responsibilities.
And Sarab, do you feel or see that motivation coming from those countries to help and to assist, and in some cases simply to fund?
And absolutely. And I think, of course, I think this needs sort of finance at a much, much larger scale than what we're seeing right now. I think what we really need is capital that is prepared to take some kind of risk, especially in the global south, so that governments and communities are not being asked to carry the entire burden of experimenting and investing in resilience. And I think there is another question here, is how do we take something that's been working in one community or one valley, or even in a different country, and scale that to an entire landscape or river basin? And I think the recognition of the fact that investing in nature is not simply an environmental investment, but that it's an investment in water security, food security, livelihoods, infrastructure, and human security, that is very, very important for the entire world, right? And the bigger point here around investment is, I think we need, this is high time now, that we need to be able to look at disasters like this one and say, how do we respond? But more so, how do we make the next disaster less devastating? Because we're going to be seeing more extreme weather events. We cannot prevent every flood. We cannot prevent every landslide or every glacial event. But what we can do is drive investments into the right places to scale the right things to reduce overall vulnerability.
Yeah, moments like this, as you say, important to have those conversations, aren't they? Sourav Malhotra and Tom Rivett-Carnac, thank you both.
It's 18 minutes to nine. Violence by Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank is set to reach record levels this year as human rights groups warn that they are increasingly spreading into new areas of the territory. Attacks on Palestinians have risen under Israel's current government alongside a rapid increase in Israeli settlements, which are illegal under international law. Our Middle East correspondent, Lucy Williamson, has been looking at reports of settler violence across the West Bank in the course of 1 week.
A teenager shot dead, beatings, arson attacks, a donkey tortured. You might have seen the worst attacks by Jewish settlers here in the occupied West Bank, but behind those lies a much wider campaign of violence against Palestinians. We've counted more than 60 incidents here just in the past week, including daily incursions and intimidations that never make the news, some of which aren't even reported by the victims at all.
Hey!
On Saturday, amputee Syed Alamour was beaten by a settler with an iron bar as he stooped to pick up one of his crutches. A shocking video recording the assault clearly shows his attacker, who's now under arrest. Saeed, who lost his leg last year after being shot near his house by a settler security guard, says settlers are constantly harassing the family.
They want me to leave this place. It's not only me who is targeted, it's everyone. If I leave, they'll go after my neighbor down the road, then the next one, then the one after that, until they remove everyone from these areas and replace them with Zionists.
On Friday, a large group of Jewish settlers, some of them armed, walked through the Palestinian village of Sa'ir near Hebron. Past the house of 17-year-old Karim Shalaldeh. His father, Sanad, told us Karim was killed while filming the settlers.
The second bullet struck my son. I ran to him before he fell and held him in my arms. I would rather die myself 1,000 times than see it happen to my child.
Israel's army said it had received reports of Palestinians throwing stones. Karim's mother, Saul, 8 months pregnant, said she had lived each day in fear of losing her children.
I was not able to hold him or say goodbye. My heart breaks over Karim. I wish I could have just one more day with him.
Each reminder of the settler outpost nearby, now more painful for the family.
Last night, they started flashing a spotlight at us, Karim's father told me, as if to say, we killed your son, and it doesn't matter. Jewish settlements here, illegal under international law, are expanding, and settler attacks are rising as well. The Israeli human rights organization, Yesh Din, says more than 90% of police investigations into settler violence end without indictment.
There is a problem of violence in the West Bank.
Doron Spielman, a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister's office, spoke to the BBC late last month.
There are Jews who are a very small number of Jews. They are human beings. They have names. They're not just called settlers, who have, in fact, been prosecuted by the police by the vast, the largest estimate would be maybe 300 or 400 youth that are involved in this out of a population of 750,000.
This week, Zvi Sukkot, a settler lawmaker in Israel's governing coalition, filmed himself destroying a village memorial in the West Bank because, he said, it honoured terrorists. It triggered a rebuke from Israel's foreign minister and from the office of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Jewish settlers were also filmed torturing a donkey, tying it to their vehicle and dragging it along until it was dead. A sadistic act of aggression that shocked Israelis more than it shocked Palestinians.
Lucy Williamson reporting there. Well, here in the UK, signs are that the new Prime Minister Andy Burnham and his new Foreign Secretary Ed Miliband are considering new sanctions on Israel, in particular a trade ban on goods originating from settlements in the West Bank. Matthew Gould is a former UK ambassador to Israel. He held the post from 2010 to 2015 and joins us now. Good morning, Mr. Gould.
Good morning.
I appreciate you were advising prime ministers and foreign secretaries in a different moment in the Middle East, but if you were advising this prime minister and this foreign secretary now, what would you tell them about how to go about this?
Well, I think I'd say three things. First of all, I would do this in company. It's much better. It's likely to be more effective and it's less likely to lead to blowback to the UK if you're doing this with others who feel similarly. Secondly, and this is obviously laying aside the question of whether it's the right thing to do at all, but if you are going to do it, then I would be tempted to try and use the leverage that the threat of it gives you to try and stop some of the most egregious settlement developments rather than play the card immediately. I mean, in practice, the level of trade, amount of imports from settlements in the West Bank to the UK is very small. So it's a largely symbolic or political measure. Once you've played the card, it's gone. So at this point, I would be saying to ministers, hold out the promise of doing this if the E1 settlement development goes ahead, rather than do it immediately. And then the third thing I'd say is be very clear about the scope, because if you're not careful, there's everything from a narrow ban on goods made in settlements to trying to sanction any company that's involved in any way in the settlement economy. One is quite tight and there are ways to do it. The other one is enormous and could easily shade into sanctions on Israel proper.
Well, you talked there in your second point about using the leverage of the threat of doing this. So you do think that the UK does have leverage here?
It has a very small amount of leverage, and I don't think there's a real danger of hubris here. We are at best, I think, a third level of countries that have influence on the Israeli government. Obviously, in the first tier is America. In the second tier are the friendly Arab states. Of course, Israel cares what we and Europe think, but not so much that we can expect to have an enormous impact.
Do you mean the Israeli government there or the Israeli people, or is there a difference?
Well, I think in this case, both. My experience of dealing with both Israeli politicians and the Israeli public is that they rather discount what they hear from Europe, which is always We're a friend, but we're a critical friend, and therefore we're going to tell you all the ways you need to do things differently. So there is a real risk that they tune us out and that we therefore overplay our hand and use what small leverage we do have to less effect than we might have. If we are thinking about imposing sanctions on goods from settlements, that does create a bit of leverage, and I would rather we used it for something than just played it symbolically.
OK, Matthew Gould, it's a subject to which I'm sure we'll return, but for now we have to leave it there. Thank you for your insight. Former British Ambassador to Israel, Matthew Gould there.
It's 10 to 9 now. Hundreds of extra police officers are being drafted into the Cleveland Police Force area after the fatal crash on the A66, which killed two officers and five other people. And then a series of incidents following that around Middlesbrough and East Cleveland as organised crime in the area is investigated. Cleveland Police has said that staff from the National Crime Agency, as well as its neighbouring forces in Northumbria and North Yorkshire, have been brought in. But even further afield as well, South and West Yorkshire, Humberside, as well, Durham. There's a lot of movement on this story. Let's speak to Alison Freeman, our correspondent, who is in Middlesbrough. Alison, have they indicated whether there are specific tensions, specific threats that they're dealing with, or is this about showing a strong police presence at a moment of tension?
I think you might be in the ballpark there, Anna, because I'm outside Cleveland Police Central Headquarters at the moment. And throughout the morning, while we've been sat here, we've seen a large number of uniformed officers arriving and being sent out. It definitely is a show of strength. We know that around 200 officers have been sent from various forces, the forces that you described there. We've seen their police vans arriving. I think that it's a week that we're coming up to now since this all started. It was the early hours of Saturday morning when that car crash took place, which took seven lives. Since then, there have been numerous other incidents, including the fatal fire, which happened on Wednesday, which took the lives of a woman in her 30s and a seven-year-old child who was her niece. And it really is that although Cleveland Police haven't outright said that they are linking all of these incidents, every time they have said that they are considering whether organised crime is a factor in all of these things. The leader of the local council has come out and said that the people who live and work here deserve to feel safe, and he's still going to be writing to the Prime Minister to ask for even more support. There were a group of Labour MPs from the area as well who've approached the government and said that something needs to be done and that a return to what they called business as usual, so going back to the numbers of police officers that there were prior to this, is simply not going to be good enough. And Andy Burnham himself has said that he's going to do what he can to support the area, but there's definitely a sense, a feeling amongst the people who live here, the majority of people who live here, that the spotlight on these incidents has shown the area in a light that they don't believe that, and that doesn't represent the area that they live and work in, Anna.
Yeah, what is interesting as well is that the different levels of response that they've been here, from tension on the streets, as you were describing there, but you also talked about some of those political rows which have blown up online as well, and that there is a sense too, you're right, that people feel that this is absolutely not representative of their community, but also there are people who live in those areas around Grangetown, South Bank, around Middlesbrough, and they will say, we have had problems for years and there hasn't always been the support there that we've needed.
Yeah, I think one of the local MPs, Luke Meyer, was very clear in what he said yesterday, which was he's saying that this is an area that's facing metropolitan levels of crime, metropolitan types of crime. But because the way the police force and the fire service is funded, they're facing rural levels of funding. So they don't have the tools that they need to tackle this type of crime. We talk about the community that's up in arms about this, but also there has been some images circulating on social media overnight of a vigil that's been or a so-called vigil that was held for one of the young men that died in the crash last Saturday morning, which appeared to show cars being set on fire, balloons being let off into the air and flares being set off. We've had no response from the police so far. We expect them to be talking about that later on, but that does just go to demonstrate the different kinds of issues that the police and the fire service here are having to deal with on the ground, Anna.
Yeah, and that even drawing in a neighbouring force in Durham, that one as well. Thank you, Alison. Alison Freeman, our correspondent in Middlesbrough.
It's 5 minutes to nine, and over on Radio 3, Tom McKinney is about to end the week with Hummel's Trumpet Concerto. It's light-hearted, it's joyous, and it even contains a hidden joke, which would have had audiences at the time rolling around on the floor laughing. Let's see if it has the same effect over on Radio 3 in a bit. But now something that is really rather different to Hummel's Trumpet Concerto. Grand Theft Auto, one of the most successful and most influential video game series of all time, and its sixth edition, as many will know, is coming later this year. Gamers have had to wait 13 years since the last instalment was released and had to wait 18 months since they got their last official glimpse of what GTA 6 might have in store. But last night, the developer, Rockstar, released a 26-minute preview. Here's a flavour.
I guess they know we're coming.
Yep.
What have you gotten yourselves into? I want to know everything.
I want to thrust! What now?
So why is Grand Theft Auto so influential and what does this release mean for the video games industry? To discuss that, we're joined by Shay Thompson, a gaming presenter, and Jason Kingsley, who's CEO of Rebellion Games, an Oxford-based video game developer behind the Sniper Elite series and Atomfall, the latter of which won Best British Game at last year's BAFTA Awards. Thanks both for joining us. Shay, let's start with you. Maybe just give the uninitiated a flavour of what Grand Theft Auto actually is, what kind of game it is.
So the Grand Theft Auto games are typically like sort of sandbox, meaning they're sort of like well-contained environments, and they see you typically committing loads of criminal activity. I think that's the best way I can sort of put it on the radio this morning.
Sure. And what did you make of the trailer? Plenty of criminal activity in there?
Oh, plenty. Plenty to keep players engaged for a very, very long time. I'll admit, I am somebody who, I'm quite sort of ambivalent towards the GTA series, but I was really, really blown away with everything I saw that was revealed last night.
And Jason Kingsley, you've been in the video games industry for a long time. What kind of an impact did Grand Theft Auto have when it first was released and then with successive releases?
Well, it's just monstrous. I mean, I played it in the old days. I played Grand Theft Auto 2 and 3, where it was top-down. It was successful, but it wasn't this giant beast of an entertainment product. I think we should be very proud of this game, actually, in the UK. It's made by a team up in Scotland who are incredibly talented, and it is the biggest entertainment launch on the planet. It eclipses the biggest movies you've ever heard of, and it's a huge amount of soft power, and I'm just thrilled that the games industry has come from its early days a few decades ago, where people were buying cassettes off the back of classified ads in magazines, to now where we've got something that is bigger than Hollywood and bigger than TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, just to give people a sense, £2 billion is the rumoured budget for GTA 6. As you say, that is absolutely staggering. What kind of impact does it have on other developers like you? I mean, is there a sort of sense of a rising tide lifting all boats as people are excited about gaming for Grand Theft Auto? They might buy other games?
Well, there's definitely that. There's also the phenomenon of you don't want to be releasing in the sort of release window of Grand Theft Auto. It removes the monetary oxygen from the industry, because pretty much everybody who's a gamer buys the game, and so they have no money left. So everybody moves their releases earlier or later. And one of the challenges there is they've moved their release a little bit. So I imagine it's caused some consternation in boardrooms throughout the world.
A sense there, I think, of quite what a behemoth it is. Shay Thompson, just back to you. What does success look like for Rockstar North, a developer based in Edinburgh, as Jason said? It's more these days, isn't it, about getting people to game online?
Yes, and so I think that is certainly a part of it. As it stands, there are no
there hasn't been anything sort of announced or discussed around GTA 6 online, which the online component to GTA 5 was massive. You know, that was a big revenue